You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the March 7, 2018 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. During the week, you hear announcements on KZYX, what we refer to as promos for forthcoming shows, some recorded and some read by other programmers. The one I wrote for today's program, written a week ago, noted that I would, quote, speak with Grant Smith, director of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, about the censorship of articles unfavorable to Israel in the U.S. media, and get Smith's report on a conference on the Israel lobby and U.S. policy the Smith Institute is co-hosting at the National Press Club in Washington on March 2nd, featuring well-known U.S. and Israeli public figures that the mainstream media is almost certain to ignore, end quote. Well, in truth, I was certain, not almost certain, about that, and I turned out to be right. With the exception that it being a Washington event, the conference was carried live by C-SPAN 2 and will be available on YouTube for those who may discover its existence on their own. Moreover, KZYX is likely to be the only public radio station where anything will be said about the conference, as well as on a subject which is equally verboten and which I will be discussing with Grant Smith at 20 minutes past the hour, and that's the censorship of news unfavorable to Israel by our national media. It is only logical that the domination and intimidation of U.S. media, however one describes it, would be obligatory in order for the Israel lobby, most visibly represented in the public arena by AIPAC, to maintain its influence over our political processes and national dialogue on issues relating to Israel and the Middle East. AIPAC clearly doesn't want the media writing or talking about that, since it would likely raise questions of dual loyalty and whether Israel's intrusion into American political life might require its own special investigation and registration as a foreign agent. Hence, news about a conference designed to expose that sordid reality, and last Friday was the fifth of such conferences, must be suppressed, and so it was, with Democracy Now! No less than NPR proving to be no exception in maintaining radio silence. At the same time, coverage of AIPAC's annual policy convention, the biggest of its kind that takes place in the nation's capital every spring, the most recent in Washington's convention center over the past 3 days, is very selective, if for no other reason than the media, including members of the Jewish Press Corps, is strictly monitored and restricted from attending what are described as breakout sessions, during which American politicians, primarily members of Congress, can feel free to express their devotion to Israel, a foreign country, without being called out on it later. This led to the editors of one prominent Jewish publication, New York's Jewish Week, to publish an editorial on February 28th explaining with a big headline, quote, why we won't be at the AIPAC conference, end quote. A year ago, noted the paper, we editorialized against the policy of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, that bars members of the press from attending the great majority of breakout sessions that take place during the pro-Israel lobby's annual national policy conference in Washington, D.C. We argued that by allowing the press to attend the largest and most important gathering of its kind in the Jewish community and then banning coverage of most of its sessions, AIPAC was creating a recipe for quote-unquote frustration and offense, and that it was better to keep us out altogether. Better yet, we said, was to open up the process more widely to the media, reflecting a core value that America and Israel cherish and share in common, freedom of the press, end quote. Despite discussions with AIPAC, the lobbying organization, which has a history of shutting the spotlight and controlling a message, the issue of press access would not be resolved. The Jewish Week editorial said as much, quote, Israel has a long history of being wary of and less than friendly toward the press. Members of the press enter the AIPAC convention through a separate entrance and must be accompanied by staff to proceed to the main area where sessions are held, accompanied to the restrooms at times. Such treatment doesn't foster trust and mutual respect. AIPAC officials, the editorial went on, say the press is overly critical in its coverage of the lobby. Maybe, suggests the Jewish Week editorial, there's a reason that goes beyond political ideology. Trying a more open approach could help, end quote. For most of its seven-decade history, AIPAC made it a point to be bipartisan, and while it has moved dramatically to the right in recent years, support for Israel remains the only issue which, at the beginning and end of the day, members of Congress of both parties not only lock arms but compete for who loves Israel the most. That the same is no longer true of their base has been a concern of Democrat Party leaders. At the last two presidential party conventions, they had to work overtime to stifle grassroots efforts to add planks to the Democratic platform that would condemn Israeli settlements and support Palestinian rights. At the 2016 convention, candidate Hillary Clinton's point person in the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, had Berkeley's liberal black Congresswoman Barbara Lee do the hatchet job on the Palestinians, casting the deciding vote against including any issue on the Middle East in the platform, assuming correctly that the news, even if it got out, would not affect her popularity. There is no guarantee that such tactics will work again in 2020, and has the Democratic National Committee understandably concerned. And this is reflected in some of the comments of Democratic politicians who spoke at AIPAC's convention, which was also carried live on C-SPAN 2. Each year, AIPAC's convention is bigger than the one preceding it, usually by 2,000 attendees, according to its press release. And this year's attracted 18,000, a figure not to be argued with after viewing widescreen photos of the packed arena. Like last year, the total reportedly included as guests 4,000 college students and what was speculated earlier to be two-thirds of the members of Congress, each of whose names is slowly read as if on an honor roll. This is intended, no doubt, to let well-heeled AIPAC members know where to send their donations come election time, while allowing those whom some might excuse for selling out, who might accuse of selling out their country, to thump up their chest, if only for a moment. In any case, 32 members of Congress either spoke or were interviewed at the event, 17 of whom were Democrats, 15 Republicans, including, as is the case every year, the most prominent officials in both parties. The comments of Charles Schumer, the ranking Democrat in the Senate, were as usual problematic. Schumer, whose name, he claims, means in Hebrew defender of the ghetto, seems to have a problem knowing what country he's supposed to defend. At the end of his presentation Monday, one already riddled with mistruths about Palestinians, Schumer recalled how, quote, last summer Congress, Democrats and Republicans together, granted the administration new authority to counter Iran's malign activity. Now it must use it not only to combat Iran, but to push Russia to repel Iranian proxies in Syria. We can never be complacent about any threat near Israel's border, and Iran is a threat right now. So we must do these things and more to ensure Israel's security, end quote. As he has at past AIPAC conferences, the leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate, not an important position, closed his speech with a shout, "I'm Israel Chai," Hebrew for "the Jewish people live." With some of the speakers, most notably Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, U.S. Representative Nikki Haley, and Vice President Mike Pence, the arena took on the atmosphere and image of a Nuremberg rally. As Palestinian professor Hamid Daveshi describes it, quote, in these prototypical shots, you see high-ranking U.S. officials, presidents, vice presidents, senators, congresspersons, ambassadors, etc., appearing on a podium with the word AIPAC in capitals powerfully spread over their chest and shot from a low angle, projecting how powerful they are to the others. Joseph Goebbels and Leni Riefenstahl, noted Habashi, could not have done any better staging a fascist duet of images to project and assert global power, end quote. The most notable presentation had to be that of Nikki Haley, who from her first day on the job as Washington's delegate to the UN Security Council saw part of her job as working for Israel. She not only has made frequent trips there, but most frequently she bragged to her entranced audience how she traveled to Guatemala and Honduras to personally thank their presidents for supporting the U.S. when the General Assembly rejected U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and her successful effort to convince the president of Guatemala, Jimmy Gonzalez, to join the U.S. in recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Gonzalez was rewarded by AIPAC with a prominent speaking spot Sunday night. His appearance must have been particularly distressing to those aware of Israel's prominent role in the massacre of hundreds of thousands of Indians in the Guatemalan highlands in the 1980s, when, After Jimmy Carter cut off military aid to the country for its human rights abuses, Israel rushed in with weapons, uniforms, and training for the country's army of murderers. Haley also repeated Trump's promise to make those countries that did not support the U.S. decision on Jerusalem to pay for it when it came to foreign aid. "We were taking names," she proudly said. What was more important and clear from her presentation is that her goal is the White House. The Haaretz reporter also picked up on that. Quote, "Nikki Haley wows pro-Israel lobby AIPAC. For me, she's the next president," read its headline. Those were the sentiments of reporter Allison Kaplan Summer, who wrote, quote, "If the AIPAC conference had been the GOP Iowa presidential caucuses, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence would be facing a formidable challenge if he aspired to succeed U.S. President Donald Trump. Haley would have beaten him hands down," end quote. In the end, that might be the biggest story from the convention. On the day before his own presentation, Netanyahu and Trump had a friendly 2.5-hour get-together at the White House, during which the Israeli Prime Minister acknowledged what the U.S. media has yet to report. The strategic intelligence agreement signed between the two countries on December 12th to go jointly after Iran. After telling Trump how much Israelis admire him for his decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel, Netanyahu said, quote, "They see your position on Iran. They see your magnificent defense of Israel and the truth in the United Nations. And I, as Prime Minister, see something that you as President see, but others can't see. It's the extent of our intelligence and other cooperation in matters that are vital for the security of both our peoples." End quote. As I pointed out on previous programs, the Israeli public is aware of that cooperation because the intelligence agreement has been reported in its media. It is only the American public that has been kept in the dark regarding what appears to be the beginning of a plan by both countries to launch a war on Iran that would likely encompass Syria as well as Lebanon, if not begin in one of those two countries. That was the subject of the talk by retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Colin Powell of the State Department, at the conference on the Israel lobby and American policy that the media did not cover. In his speech to AIPAC, Netanyahu kept up the drumbeat, saying, quote, "Iran must be stopped and it will be stopped," he said that twice, after ripping once again apart the deal signed with Iran by the U.S. and other foreign members of the Security Council, plus Germany, that led to Tehran shutting down its nuclear enrichment program and getting rid of the stock of enriched uranium in exchange for ending of economic sanctions. The significant concessions on Iran's part are rarely, if ever, mentioned in the U.S. media. The benefits expected by Iranians following the ending of those sanctions have not materialized and, not surprisingly, has led to divisions in Iranian society between what were called on the West moderates and hardliners. AIPAC, which pressured the Senate to pass a bill obligating the president to certify Iran's compliance with the agreement every 90 days, can't take much of the credit or blame for that. The legislation was no problem for Obama, but Trump has made it clear that unless there are changes made to the agreement that are to Israel's liking, and his liking, the U.S. will pull out, though this is opposed by all the other signatories and the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has found Iran to be in full compliance with what it promised. Such is the power of Israel over what is purportedly the world's only superpower, and it was on full display in all its ugliness at the AIPAC convention. On the stage of the Washington Convention Center, Netanyahu was clearly in his element, saying, "After all, I'm the prime minister," and he abandoned the podium to stride back and forth across the long stage, talking into a concealed microphone as if he was a nightclub entertainer and not a politician, hounded by the police in Israel on charges of corruption and on the verge of indictment of a possible prison term. On a local note, back in 2015, in a story that is relevant for this moment, our representative in Congress, Jared Huffman, had the temerity to criticize Netanyahu when the Israeli Prime Minister was invited to speak to a joint session of Congress by then-House Speaker John Boehner in a last-ditch attempt to sabotage Obama's nuclear deal with Iran. Responding to Netanyahu's warning that the nuclear deal being negotiated with Iran is a bad one, According to the Marin Independent Journal, Huffman said, quote, "This is a prime minister who's never seen a war he didn't want our country to fight," end quote. And as Huffman reacted to Netanyahu's speech, according to the paper, staunch supporters of Israel reacted to Huffman's reaction. Michael Harris of San Rafael, one of the founders of the San Francisco Voice for Israel, a branch of the hardcore Stand With Us group, said, "I know that Congressman Huffman is pro-Israel. His pro-Israel credentials are impeccable, which is why I'm disappointed in the comment. If you look at Netanyahu's speech, nowhere in there is he making any reference whatsoever to military action," Harris said. "He's simply saying that the alternatives to a bad deal is a better deal, and Israel, more than any other country, requires an effective deal to peacefully resolve the issue," end quote. Huffman replied, "Yeah, but he set hypothetical bars so high for what would constitute a good deal, in his opinion, that he was effectively taking a diplomatic solution off the table," end quote. Huffman, who attended Netanyahu's speech, unlike some of four dozen House and Senate Democrats who boycotted it, said Netanyahu's judgment has proved fallible in the past. "He implored us to go to war in Iraq," Huffman said, telling us that if we took out Saddam Hussein, that the entire region would be stabilized and good things would come as a result. "He implored us to go to war in Syria over chemical weapons when, in fact, we were able to find a negotiated solution to that problem. It's still ugly in Syria, but it would have been much uglier had we heeded his advice," end quote. Those are the words of Representative Jared Huffman back in 2015 that might have been spoken today. I emailed the congressman yesterday to see if it had anything more to say on the subject. As of this morning, I hadn't heard back from him. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine. طفلة تمتطي فوسا قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم جري.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. In the course of gathering resources each week in preparation for This Week in Palestine, I read and listen to a myriad of articles, speeches, and presentations of various sorts, and did so again this week, and came across one of Mazen Kumsaya's email reports from Bethlehem. Mazen is a remarkable human being. He is a Palestinian geneticist who taught for many years at Duke University and Yale University, but eventually returned to his native Palestine, where he continues to teach, but also has developed a museum of natural history at Bethlehem University. He is also an activist involved in the resistance to the occupation. Mazen frequently writes email reports from Bethlehem, where he comments on his work in the museum and the latest political struggles. He often adds links to informative articles and reports. This morning I want to read a recent report that Mazen sent to his network. It is typical Mazen. Filled with struggle and news of the occupation, but also included glimpses of hope, always pointing to ways that we all can be involved in the resistance. Here is Mazen Kumsaya writing from Bethlehem. It remains a remarkable era that we live in, and it is getting more interesting every day. Take, for example, the poke in the eye that the Zionists did through their vassal president, Donald Trump, in deciding that the date to move the U.S. embassy to occupy Jerusalem will be May 15th. This is a very significant date because that date is Nakba Commemoration Day, when, against the wishes of the vast majority of inhabitants, a Jewish apartheid state was created by force of arms. Before and after that date, the largest post-World War II ethnic cleansing happened. Most of the native people of Palestine, of various religions, were pushed out and 530 towns and villages were depopulated. Today, 7 million people are refugees or displaced people. 6.3 million live under the direct Israeli racist rule. None have sovereignty over their lands. Immigrant Ashkenazi white European elites rule the apartheid state. The 1.6 million Palestinians who had lived under martial law until 1966 and then given some citizen rights, but are subjected to further ethnic cleansing, home demolitions, colonial settlement expansion, just as much as the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. There is a meticulous and vicious program of slow genocide in Gaza. In Jerusalem, West Bank, there are more and more pressures to Judaize the city by programs of denial of residency and recently the escalation of pressure on Christian and Muslims to strip them of church and mosque property by overtaxing them to bankruptcy in order to take their church and mosque property. This week, the Christian churches, including the Church of the Sepulchre, closed their doors in protest. To my knowledge, this has never happened before in 2,000 years. The world politicians are silent, and the Palestinian Authority issue feeble sounds of pleading for the world community to implement international law and also to protect the Palestinian people. Yet they all continue their failed policies and do not admit that they made any mistakes. As any rational reader of history knows, rights are never begged for from your oppressor. Oppressors must be forced to give up their powers. Resistance must be built up in all its forms, sanctioned by international law. Mahmoud Abbas, whose term expired years ago and whose health is deteriorating, wish him to finally retire, gave a speech at the UN Security Council in which he admitted that his authority basically works for the Israeli occupiers. Thus, the first and main obstacle now to liberation, return of refugees, self-determination in Palestine, is the Vichy government in Ramallah. It is long past time to end the charade of Oslo and create a real Palestine liberation organization. To be clear, Palestine is all of Palestine, not the disputed 22% of it, West Bank and Gaza, for which they have been negotiating endlessly. Liberation, as liberty, not accepting apartheid or the racist notions of a Jewish state. This also includes the right of native Palestinians to return to their homelands. Organization, as people organizing to capture the amazing energy of the 12.5 million Palestinians around the world. That requires participatory democracy, not a clique of comprador elites. Term limits of 6 to 8 years are a good idea for all leaders. Every day here, as we work the land and work with people, we see the incredible energy and incredible opportunities. Just this week, we planted over 200 native trees, carob, oak, azarole, pistachio, and worked with children from age 3 to 83. We launched projects on climate change, on sustainability, on biodiversity, on ecotourism, and on permaculture, one founded by the National Geographic. We watch our friends in Israeli jails, like four members of the Tamimi family in Munthar Amara. We miss some who departed recently. For example, we lost Gail Kure, a great friend of us and of all Palestinians. We planted a tree in her honor, and a mutual friend is donating money to the museum in her honor. Life goes on in all its ingredients, good ones and bad ones, people who lie and cheat, and people who help and donate and work and give of themselves. We in Palestine and visiting and volunteer friends from around the world remain having joyful participation in the joys and the sorrows of this world. We trim the dead branches and see growth of new ones. Spring in Palestine is beautiful, with a tapestry of colors of plants, smell of blossoms everywhere, taste of fresh winter crops from our garden and greenhouses, and the spirit of people who defied all odds. 60% of our people are under the age of 18, and we work with some of them regularly. We see hope in their eyes. Life is still good. We savor it. Join us as we refuse to behave like dead fish, but indeed swim against the current. Collectively, we feel alive by the effort and perpetuate humanity. That was vintage Mazen Kumsia, writing from Bethlehem, a voice that we need to continue to elevate. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is a presentation by Yousef Munayer, delivered at the Harvard JFK School of Government. Yousef Munayer is a writer and political analyst, and currently is executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Here is Yousef Munayer speaking at the Harvard JFK School of Government.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you all for the kind invitation and for turning out tonight. It's great to see the turnout here, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I know in the flyer for this event I saw that it said that you'd be hearing a Palestinian perspective, and that is true. Sorry, the mic is not on.
Just closer.
How's that? Good? So as I was saying, I know the flyer said you'd hear a Palestinian perspective, and that is true. And while I do come to this issue as a student of politics and policy, I also come to this issue from other places as well, which is important for me to tell you about, I believe. I come first to this issue as a human being who happens to be Palestinian, who happens to also be an Israeli citizen, who happens to also be an American citizen. And despite any adventures and studies on this issue, I would be lying to you to say that those experiences did not help define and inform the perspective that I'm sharing with you today. So I was asked to speak about Trump's policy towards Palestine and his recent decisions regarding funding for UNRWA, as well as the Jerusalem decision. And we will cover all of those issues. But I want to begin by saying also to the students who are traveling to take the trek, you have no shortage of resources at this university. There's no shortage of information at your fingertips here. Fantastic historians, scholars, endless volumes of books on this conflict. there is nothing like seeing for yourself what is taking place on the ground. And so I'm very glad that you are going to be making this trip. I look forward, if it is possible, to hearing from you again about your experiences there and what it is that you've learned. So with that, we turn to our topic now, and it is a well-timed moment to be discussing this. If you've been following the news today, there was a speech given at the United Nations Security Council by the chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority, which is a rare event. He laid out in his speech his reaction to the position of the American administration under President Trump and the shifts in policy that have been made since he has taken office, in particular regarding to the question of Jerusalem and American recognition of Jerusalem. But his message to the Security Council was bigger than just any particular policy issue. It was a message that asked for the international community to intervene in ways that they have not intervened before. And so, if we are to understand what it is that Trump has brought that is different to the question of U.S. policy on Palestine, I think it's important to understand a little bit what preceded it to fully appreciate the impact of the positions that he has taken and the shift that it represents. I think from a Palestinian perspective, it is fair to say that the peace process as it has existed from the early 1990s through 2016 is one that Palestinians would have considered to be unfair and biased towards Israel because of the way in which it was mediated. And it was mediated, of course, primarily by Washington, with some exceptions for periodic multilateral interventions that ultimately end up being dominated by Washington at the end of the day. And when there are international interventions, like, for example, resolutions that come to the floor of the United Nations Security Council considering questions related to Palestine, whether or not they move forward is based largely on whether or not the United States will agree. And we know that over the last 30 years or more, there have been about 40 different resolutions, maybe up to 42 now, where the United States has been the single solitary veto in the United Nations Security Council on resolutions concerning the Israel-Palestine question. And so even when there are multilateral approaches to this issue, the United States finds a way to continue monopolizing the direction that it takes. And all of this, of course, is before President Trump. And immediately before President Trump, we saw at the United Nations Security Council a resolution that came to the floor in December of 2016. And this was, of course, after the election, but before the Trump administration took office, a resolution that the United States actually did not veto. They did not support, but they did not veto the resolution. And the resolution did a number of things. This is UN Security Council Resolution 2334. The resolution did a couple of different things. It condemned, of course, Israeli settlement expansion as being illegal under international law. And that was the headline that dominated the conversation around that resolution. But more importantly, I believe, one of the things that the resolution did, buried down in the text, was really let out a cry of desperation, the last gasps of the two-state solution as it relates to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And there it said that urgent steps had to be taken within a defined period of time to salvage the two-state solution. And so this is the context in which the transition from what has been, let's call it, conventional peace process policy, again, in the view of Palestinians, very much already biased towards Israel, to Trump peace process policy, which is something very different. So what is it that Trump brought that was very different? And before we get into that, I should say that in the immediate aftermath of that vote, as many of you will recall, the Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, delivered a very important speech at the State Department outlining the American rationale for why they took the decision that they did and why the position that they took was so important, not just for the Palestinians, but for Israel as well. And what he said in his speech, and I would urge all of you to go back and look at the text, because it was an important message at the time, albeit in my view, many decades too late. What he said in the speech was that if there is no two-state solution, what you have between the river and the sea is essentially an apartheid regime. He did not use the word apartheid, though. The words that he used are ones that are much more familiar to our American context. He said what you have is separate and unequal. And of course, as Palestinians we know, and I believe as Susan laid out very clearly, the policies of separate and unequal have been in place since the very advent of the state, written into law. Enter President Trump, or President-elect Trump at this point. We had indications of where President Trump's policy was going to go. The indications, of course, came from things that he said, and also the people that he put around him. Among the things that he said during the campaign, for example, among the many, many different problematic things that he said, was a very sort of standard right-of-center approach to the Israeli-Palestinian issue delivered at the annual AIPAC convening in the summer. But it was after that that we began to understand a little bit more about exactly what his approach was going to be and who he was going to be surrounding himself with. In particular, his advisors on Israel, Jason Greenblatt and David Friedman. And if anyone is familiar with these two characters, you will know that they are not only very close to the politics of the Israeli right, but in many ways, the fringe of the Israeli right. And if you have followed the David Friedman saga, will know, for example, that Friedman was not just an activist, a pro-settlement activist, but actually participated in the financing of Israeli settlements deep inside the West Bank, including some of the most ideological settlements and settlements that are really central to the vision of the settler movement, which I think is important. And if you followed his writings in the right-wing fringe outlets in which he was publishing in Israel, you will have seen him argue essentially that there is no need for Palestinians to have equal rights. Also that Jews who disagree with Israel's policies, liberal Jews essentially, are equal to collaborators with the Nazis. So this is the person that is advising Donald Trump on Israel policy and was the first person who he named to a appointment as ambassador. And, of course, named him as ambassador to Israel. So we had a sense of where this was going. But it was not really clear what the specific policy shifts were going to be. So about a year ago, around this time, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, came to the White House to visit, was, I believe, the first foreign leader after Theresa May to come to the United States, was embraced, of course, with open arms by President Trump shortly after the United States abstained on that veto. And standing beside Prime Minister Netanyahu, Donald Trump said something that many people found perhaps bizarre, funny at the time, maybe reflective of his, shall we say, lack of education on this issue. And he essentially said, well, our policy is one state, two state, whatever they want. Well, you know, whatever they want is good. And it was because of our familiarity with Donald Trump, it was very easy, of course, to dismiss this as a sort of Trumpism, if you will, as ignorance toward the issue. But I would say a couple things. First of all, anytime the President of the United States says something when it comes to policy, it is not insignificant, even if it is not intentional. But also, what we heard from Donald Trump is in many ways a continuation of previous American policy. And what I mean by that is the last administration sent out this call of desperation for the two-state solution. The next administration is starting to say, well, maybe time's up. Now, where are we going? I'm sure Palestinians have a very different vision than what Donald Trump and some of his advisors have. But the recognition that time is up, I think, is an important one to underscore. Second, it is a recognition of the reality that the parties themselves are no longer on the same page when it comes to the outcome of the negotiations, the goal of the negotiations. There was a time when the Israeli government at least played along with the notion that they desired a two-state solution. But I think it's very clear now that the current Israeli government, which has been in power for a number of years, and governments like it have been in power for a number of years, have been not shy to say that they're not interested in this anymore. So for the president to say, well, whatever the two parties agree on is also a reflection of the fact that the parties no longer agree in any public way about what the shared goal of these negotiations are. I think that is important. And it's important, thirdly, because it underscores a real shift in American policy, right? For decades, the conventional peace process policy was based on an outcome that included a Palestinian state. What the contours of that state were was up for negotiation. The degree of sovereignty that state had was up for negotiation. But that was the goal. This is a marked shift away from that. What we didn't understand at the time was that this was part of a bigger shift in American policy that Donald Trump would be introducing and unfolding over the period of the next year, and God knows there may be more to come. But I would call what we've seen so far a three-pronged attack on the conventional peace process policies that the United States has put forward in decades prior. This includes this ambiguity on the outcome, which is used to be very clear in terms of what the goal was, a two-state solution. Now that is no longer the case. Second is a significant shift on U.S. policy towards the issue of Jerusalem. And we all saw that take place in recent weeks and months, the fallout continuing, of course, to today, after the president recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, something he said he would do during the campaign, but also something that every American president in recent years has promised to do in the campaign cycles, but don't because they realize how big of a problem that would be for the stated goal of trying to achieve a two-state solution. Donald Trump changed that, and that's important to recognize. And the implications of this are significant because the peace process itself, as we know it, from the very foundation of these negotiations at the 1991 Madrid conference, was based on a set of American guarantees. Guarantees that the Americans gave to the parties and said, look, if you come to the table, we guarantee X, Y, and Z. Included in that was an American guarantee on the question of Jerusalem, was that they would not recognize Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem, in particular until there was a negotiated outcome that the parties agreed on. Essentially, that this would remain an issue that would be put towards the end of an agreement, and only then would there be American recognition. So by shifting this, not only did Donald Trump shift decades of American policy that even preceded the peace process in 1991, he destroyed the very foundation that peace process that started in 1991 was built on. This is a major shift. The third of the three-pronged attack on the peace process policy is the change in the position towards UNRWA, the agency. And while this is most directly going to impact this UN agency itself, it is also tied to a narrative, an Israeli narrative, that is now increasingly being echoed by the Americans. And that is that the problems with UNRWA are not about the agency or its efficiency or anything like that, but the role it plays in perpetuating, again, this is the Israeli narrative, perpetuating the refugee crisis. So now this is no longer just an attack on the agency itself. And by attacking the agency, of course, an attack on Palestinian refugees who rely on that agency in very direct ways, but also an attack on the very idea of the right of return, which is the way in which this is being messaged and echoed by the United States if you pay very close attention to what is being said and done around this issue. So here you have a shift on the question of a Palestinian state, a shift on the question of Jerusalem, a shift on refugees. In 1 year, Donald Trump completely destroyed everything that was the foundation of an already flawed process. In some ways, I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with that because for a very long time, we were able to talk about a two-state solution for the sake of talking about a two-state solution without actually doing anything to get to that outcome. And as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton put it in emails that ultimately got leaked, a Potemkin process is better than no process at all. For Palestinians, that's not the case. We obviously do not feel that a ruse is going to help us in any way, and we would like serious engagement and solidarity from the international community to providing justice for our people. But for the United States and for Israel, a Potemkin process has a lot of benefits. And we'll get into that in a moment. But what this has revealed is that the peace process as we know it is over with. And even pretending now is no longer possible. It was possible in the past to pretend. Trump has made it impossible to pretend. And now those among us who were holding out, not wanting to confront the reality that this was a fiction, are forced to confront it. And we must ask the question, what comes next? And it is incumbent upon us to grapple with that. So, for those who are not familiar, I want to explain a little bit why, you know, from the Palestinian perspective, the peace process prior to Donald Trump was not exactly something that they had faith in. And I will do this by outlining what I refer to as the three central myths of the peace process, the conventional peace process. The first of these three myths is the idea that the creation of a Palestinian state is a U.S. national security interest. This is a lie. It is not true. It was claimed, particularly after 9/11, as part of the discourse around the need to address blowback in the region, that we have to get to a two-state solution because of that. But the reality is, it's not an American national security interest. It's not a secondary interest. Maybe it's a third level interest. And what that means is the United States does not have an interest in expending any real serious resources towards making it happen. Unfortunately, that's how foreign policy works. And what that means is that when it comes to making decisions on these foreign policy issues, other considerations come into play, particularly domestic policy. Now, there are a lot of foreign policy issues that rise to the level of a national security interest where a decision maker, where an executive will say, we have to put the domestic politics aside. This is a national security issue. Whatever the domestic politics are, we have to act in X, Y, Z ways. This is not that, despite the myth. The second myth of the peace process is this following statement, which unfortunately we heard echoed many, many times by the previous administration. And that is this: the status quo is unsustainable. The status quo is unsustainable. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which began in 1967, is now over 50 years old. It has sustained in the Middle East longer than Zain al-Abidin bin Ali, longer than Hosni Mubarak, longer than Gaddafi. Nothing in the Middle East has been as sustainable as the Israeli occupation, in large part thanks to U.S. policy. When we say, when our leaders say the status quo is unsustainable, they're not only lying, they're absolving themselves of their own responsibility in making this horrendous situation sustainable. Understanding that this is a myth is central to understanding what must come next. Finally, and again, these are in no particular order, but there are three. Ending the occupation is in Israel's interest. This is one we hear a lot, because for some reason the United States feels like it must convince Israel to do something that's good for it, and feels like it's in a position to define Israel's interests for it better than Israel is itself. That's not true, and it has never been the case. Not with Israel, not with any other country. But nonetheless, this is a myth that we keep telling. The reality is when it comes to the occupation, and when it comes to Israeli interests, there are many different intertwined layers of interests when it comes to entrenching the occupation and the notion of ending the occupation. And until you untangle that, until you understand what those economic interests are, what those political interests are, you cannot figure out a way forward. Until we are able to manipulate those interests, and we have many tools at our disposal to do that, if we are talking about policymakers, you cannot expect Israel to make the decision that it is going to end the occupation. The Israelis believe that continuing the occupation is in their interest. We are not going to convince them otherwise. Certainly not by continuing to pretend that it's unsustainable while making it sustainable. So the message that we send to the Israelis is, you should end the occupation, we'll tell everybody it's a crisis, but under the table, we'll give you several billions of dollars a year and ensure that you're protected in the United Nations Security Council. Wink, wink. So it is for these reasons that Palestinians never had faith in the previous process, and now with Trump here, it's easier for you all to see why. This brings us to the final topic that I was asked to speak to you about tonight, which is what is there for us to do about this? I think it is very clear, both from what Susan outlined, both from what I mentioned here today, and was also a central theme in what was said by Mahmoud Abbas at the United Nations today, is that the international system has failed on this issue. It has failed. Today, Abbas read off the numbers, I don't know how many hundreds of General Assembly resolutions and United Nations resolutions. Not the ones that have been presented and vetoed, the ones that have been passed but have never been enforced. The state system has failed Palestinians. And if the state system has failed Palestinians, what then can be done? Well, as you very appropriately ended your comments with, civil society has a role to play. And it is for this reason, it is because Palestinians had stared at the morass of the peace process for decades, long before Trump, that they decided that the state system was not going to save them, that they could not rely on the state system, certainly not the way that it was behaving at this point, to deliver accountability for Israeli behavior. And so Palestinians in 2005 initiated a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. and in doing so called for international solidarity in the use of these nonviolent tactics, these nonviolent forms of economic action, to hold Israel accountable until it abided by international law based on three central demands: an end to the occupation, the military occupation, which began in 1967, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel under the law, not any of this bifurcation between nationals and citizens that allows you to pretend that you have some sort of equality when you really don't, and a right of return for Palestinian refugees in accordance with international law, Susan so articulately laid out. So it is this movement, this civil society movement, launched in 2005 by members of Palestinian civil society, which is growing today around the world, which I believe in at this current moment represents the single best hope for holding Israel accountable moving forward. It is certainly not residing at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It never was. But it is residing here in this room. It is residing in rooms like this across the country, where people have an opportunity to wrestle with questions about their complicity in the oppression of Palestinians that continues to take place. And we as Americans have a particular responsibility, because not only are we making choices on a daily basis that are investing in one way or another in profiteering off of the denial of these rights, but our government is subsidizing these policies to the single largest foreign military financing expense in our budget. And so it is for this reason that when we look at what is taking place today in Washington, what has been taking place in Washington, that we continue to believe that only through these civil society efforts can things change. And ultimately, and I want to say this to be very clear, this is not my preferred method. I would much prefer that states in the international system lived up to their obligations and created policies that enforced international law when it comes to this issue. That would be my preference. That's not the case. That doesn't mean nothing can be done. And I believe that if we can work to build a movement across civil society to address accountability on this issue, one day we'll be able to create the kind of change necessary to get the states to ultimately play that role. So I will stop there.
You've been listening to Yusuf Munayyer of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, speaking at Harvard's JFK School of Government. Before we wrap up this morning, I want to quickly read one more news story that is reported this week by the Electronic Intifada, and I'm now quoting directly from the article. Israel froze a bill on Tuesday that would allow it to expropriate land sold by the Greek Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches to private developers, and postponed the collection of taxes from church-owned properties and United Nations institutions in Jerusalem. Israel's about-face comes after hundreds of Palestinians protested the measures and church leaders closed the doors of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, one of Christianity's most revered sites, which according to tradition marks the place where Jesus was crucified. The church closed for 3 days, but announced that it will reopen its doors on February 28th, following Israel's climb down. Earlier this month, Israeli authorities in Jerusalem moved to collect $186 million from 887 properties in the city belonging to churches and UN agencies by freezing their bank accounts. The organizations affected including UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Church leaders said Nir Barkat, the Israeli mayor of Jerusalem, was violating international treaties that exempt churches from state taxes. The Israeli municipality has already seized approximately $3 million from the Catholic Church, $2 million from the Anglican Church, $500,000 from the Armenian Church, and $161,000 from the Greek Orthodox Church. The heads of the Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and the Armenian churches, all three responsible for the Church of the Sepulchre, released a statement on February 25th condemning Israel's tax collection bill and its efforts to change the status quo of the city. The greatest victims in this are those impoverished families who will go without food and housing, as well as children who will be unable to attend school, they stated. This reminds us of the laws of similar nature, which were enacted against the Jews during the dark periods in Europe. The denomination leaders call Israel's actions a systematic campaign of abuse against Christian churches, and churches now reaching its peak with this discriminatory and racist bill. The church hung a protest banner saying, "Enough is enough," with pictures of Israeli Mayor Barkat and Rachel Azaria, a member of the Israeli parliament, identifying them as the two main instigators of Israel's campaign against the Christian community. What worried church leaders the most, according to Israeli newspaper Haaretz, was a measure sponsored by Azaria that would allow Israel to expropriate the land sold by churches to private developers. A relevant question is what Israel would say if such a move was taken in another country for synagogue-owned property, Haaretz reported. The bill was set to be discussed by Israel's cabinet on Sunday, but was postponed following the church's closure. That was an excerpt from a report by the Electronic Intifada concerning Israel's attempt to tax Christian churches and even the United Nations. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 676 of Unwelcome Guests. More of what we are not being told. I'm Robin Upton, and that title could serve as something of a motto for the entire show.
This is following on fairly closely from last week's, another set of important angles on history which the powers that be would rather people never took. Historical events that they would like to sweep under the carpet, embarrassing details of history which show that what's really going on is quite a long way from what we've been told is going on. In our second hour, regular speaker on the show, Tony Gosling, speaks about the corrupting nature of secret power. Now, his talk goes back centuries, but is very relevant to the present day. He uses historical parallels, and he makes it quite clear that this chicanery operated by the banksters, the so-called financial crisis, is nothing new, but it's just a more modern spin on a centuries-long process of swindling, theft, misinformation. Now, that's in our second hour. To begin with, we hear from Professor Kate Brown, whose knowledge of Russian as well as English allows her, I think, magnificently to cut through the locked-in opposition narratives of the Cold War that I grew up with. Now, last time we heard Professor Anthony Sutton on technology and money transfers, how the Soviet Union was in fact supported by the US in their efforts to make the bomb. Well, Professor Brown doesn't go that far, but she makes some very important parallels between the two superpowers' willingness to sacrifice the health and well-being of their population in the quest for plutonium. And very relevant is the willingness of workers to be bought off, to suspend any doubts they had in the health of radiation and what they were doing because of a consumer lifestyle. So there's some untold history with lessons for the present day, especially for those in the so-called developed countries. And many thanks to Ed Mays TV. This was recorded by Pirate TV in Seattle on the 22nd of July, 2013.
I want to talk about this book, Plutopia, today, and it's about the first two cities in the world to produce plutonium. And I think these are interesting cities because they show how the production of nuclear weapons changed Soviet and American societies by creating whole new kinds of communities and new definitions of citizenship, risk, and safety. And I wanted to tell you how I got onto this project. I took a holiday in 2004 in the Chernobyl zone of alienation. And while I was there, I wrote an article about it that was published in a magazine. And an editor called me up and asked me to write a book about the Chernobyl as a disaster, as a pivotal moment in history. And here's some really stupid tourist. I don't know who this person is. I don't know who would get that close to the sarcophagus. And I decided, I thought, you know, there's a lot of books about Chernobyl. And I started looking around, and I came across these two places, Mayak and Hanford. And I thought, you know, Chernobyl is a household word, but very few people have ever heard of Hanford. In Washington, more people than usual. And almost nobody's ever heard of Mayak. But these two places were, like, depending on who you're asking, were 2 to 4 times more spilled radioactive waste than Chernobyl. Each produced at least 200 million curies of radiation. Now, that's a colossal figure. So I looked into it, and I thought about, you know, there's Chernobyl and there's Fukushima, and those both were sort of media events. They were accidents that occurred in one day. They played out over the course of a couple of weeks while the cameras were running. The plutonium disasters were different. They were slow-motion disasters that occurred over 4 decades. And they weren't accidents. They were intentional spills of radioactive isotopes on a daily basis for 4 decades. And when I figured that out, that to me was a really chilling realization, because these were blue-collar plants. Thousands of people worked in them. Over the years, tens of thousands of people worked in them. And no one, until the 1980s, said anything about this. I thought, how did that happen, that all these people agreed to go along with this? This daily part of the daily working order of putting radioactive isotopes into the air and the ground and the water. And I started, you know, trying to figure out what that meant. And As I puzzled over these questions, I realized that both plutonium plants had spawned exclusive cities for specially chosen plant operators. And for me, these cities were the key to figuring out what went wrong. By creating what I call Plutopia, exclusive cities for working-class plant operators who were paid and lived like the middle classes, plant managers purchased patriotic, compliant, and silent workers. And here's an image of blue-collar workers in Russia in the 50s. And you can see the fur coats, and you can see that look of confidence. This is not the normal kind of Soviet citizen in the 1950s. And these, to me, these are the citizens of Plutopia. Now, Plutopia was an attractive model for both societies. They were places where the chosen few lived, but which appeared to deliver society's stated goals, which in both countries was a classless prosperity for everyone. Plutopia basically remade the Soviet and American post-war landscapes. They militarized them, compartmentalized them, and sullied them in ways that we have yet to fully digest. And so that's the story I want to tell you today, and I want to start at the beginning about how plutonium was made and how they created this colossal factory, this infrastructure to produce plutonium. And as I tell the story, I'm going to go back and forth between the Soviet case and the American case, because Richland, that was where the exclusive city was in eastern Washington, and Oziorsk, the one in the southern Urals, were hooked together. They were very much built in reflection of one another. And in Oziorsk, they used to say that if you drilled a hole all the way down through the earth, you'd come up in Richland. And that's how I imagine them, as two cities spinning on one axis over and over. So the Army Corps of Engineers broke ground on the American plutonium plant in 1943, and the Soviet NKVD, or KGB generals, broke ground on Mayak plant in 1946. Now, initially, American and Soviet leaders tried to produce plutonium with militarized labor in remote, secured army camp settings. And here's a picture of Camp Hanford. This was a population 60,000 built to house the construction workers for the massive factories for the Hanford plant. Now, this camp had all the charms of a minimum security prison. And it had a lot of the social problems, too. Fights, drinking, crime, gambling, rape, and murder. Here's the women's camp. And you can almost see, like, you know, over Auschwitz, Arbeit macht frei, right? Like, and they needed the barbed wire and the guards because the guys at the camp would get in and rape the women. They called them the wolves. And so the barbed wire and the fences were to keep the wolves at bay so the women could safely live. Now, they spent, this was, you know, eastern Washington was was nowhere in the 1940s, and they spent millions of dollars recruiting workers, white workers across the country, to come to this remote place and live and work. But despite the very good pay, people hated Camp Hanford. At the peak of construction in 1944, 450 people walked off the job a day. They had real trouble keeping people. At first, they only wanted to hire white workers. They thought white workers were loyal. They thought minority workers would be disloyal. But then the NAACP got involved and made a quota of that they had to hire 10% African-American workers. And so they in the camp, they set up separate quarters for facilities for colored people and for white workers. And so they basically brought Jim Crow to the Pacific Northwest. And this was duplicated everywhere in bathrooms and theaters and swimming pools, all that stuff. They hired several hundred Mexican-American workers, and they made them live 30 miles away in Pasco because they said that the black workers and the white workers would never live with the Mexican workers and that kind of stuff. They also, to solve the labor problem, they set up a prison labor camp. This was run by Prison Industries, Inc., and they brought in conscientious objectors from McNeil Island to do some of the work. These were white guys. They were considered secure. And so they built this. This is a shot from that camp. And they patrolled these places, these camps very closely. And this is an amazing shot of a African-American worker being led into a paddy wagon. She probably said something that she wasn't supposed to or was suspected of maybe having been a member of a union or some other seditious organization, and she was put into the paddy wagon and never seen again. And what's really amazing is that the camp photographer took this photograph. This is an official DuPont photographer who snapped this shot. Now, the Soviets had something called camp construction, and they built this plant between Yekaterinburg and Chelyabinsk in what is sort of the equivalent of the Russian Kansas in the interior of the country. They were thinking they wanted to deepen the interior so that the American airplanes couldn't fly over and bomb the plant. Now, in 1946, the Soviets had no luxury of hired workers in the post-war destruction of the Soviet Union. They had lost 8 million soldiers during the war, another 16 million civilians, 25 million people were homeless, and 35,000 enterprises and factories had been bombed during the war. And the Soviet Union was really among, even though they were among the victors, they were really among the defeated in terms of destruction. And so in 1946, they really had no business building a nuclear weapons complex. They had no cement, they had no steel, and they had very little labor. So the first thing they did, Stalin in 1945, handed the whole job of producing the atomic bomb to the Gulag, to the prison labor system in the Soviet Union, because the Gulag had bodies. And so they served up 40,000 workers in the form of POWs, German POWs, and prisoners and deportees who had been shoved from Western Russia to the Urals. Now, these hungry, ill-clad prisoners set to building the plutonium plant. And I think this picture shows really well how the generals who commanded these Gulag prisoners constructed the state-of-the-art nuclear plant with the technology and tools of the Egyptian pharaohs. Now, from the records, it's clear that camp construction was no model of military order and prison-like control. In 1946, the Gulag was heading for its free fall and its destruction in the 1950s, and it was falling apart. There were not enough guards, so prisoners were left to guard one another. Criminal warlords then took over running the camps, and they ruled with a terrifying violence. Prisoners drank, fought, stole, gambled, raped, and murdered. Civilian engineers lived in fear of the thief lords of the camps, and one guy who crossed one of the thief lords was found several months after he went missing, walled up in the cement foundation of the reactor. There was no regular housing. Prisoners lived in tents or in dugouts in the ground, and civilians lived in these kinds of shacks they made from found materials. So in short, I'm trying to say that in both countries, they learned that building these massive factories with soldiers and migrant workers and prisoners who boozed and brawled and had sex and took flight in uncontrollable ways was a real problem. And originally, both Soviet and American leaders had wanted to run these plutonium plants, once they got them built, with militarized labor living in garrisons. But after this experience with these two labor construction camps, they reluctantly realized that those who would operate these plants could not be as volatile as the product they were going to make. And so the solution to secure production of nuclear weaponry was, strangely enough, the nuclear family. And the Soviets really followed the Americans in this. They, in order to secure trusted workers, leaders in both countries built state-funded, limited-access cities for civilian plant workers who would live rooted in their nuclear families in these new atomic cities. And here are some pictures of these first plutopias. Here's Richland in the late 40s, contest for who got the nicest Christmas decorations, contest for who built the best snowman. You see, he's a Catholic priest. This is Azursk. Here's a Russian family. Now, to secure these cities, Manhattan Project security agents and KGB officers set up intricate security systems. They first selected their applicants for jobs by choosing them for political and ethnic reliability. In Richland, the DuPont Corporation and the FBI ran background checks, and they selected for whiteness. As a policy, DuPont rarely hired Jews. They also rejected African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, and those with leftward-leaning sympathies. And these are the kind of people that they sought to hire at the plant, and indeed did. In the Soviet Union, enterprise leaders encircled this first plutonium city with a double row of barbed wire fence, and they gave entry passes only to employees and their immediate families. They also selected for political and ethnic reliability people who were Russians and sometimes Ukrainians. A lot of Bashkirs and Tatars, a Muslim minority, lived in that area. They did not hire any of these people. And after 1948, they were seeking, you know, this anti-cosmopolitan campaign. They started firing all the Jews who were in the plant. Now, these were the workers, the select workers who ran the plant. But there were other jobs that needed to be done all the time. They were constantly building, expanding these plants as the arms race escalated, and so they needed more construction workers all the time. And they needed people to work on basically what was increasingly contaminated ground, to clean up spills, to do janitorial work, and to continue construction. So they had another kind of residence for these lower-level workers, as they called them. And these were sort of staging grounds. They lived not in the residential plutopia that was exclusively for regular permanent employees, but in sort of staging grounds that were either prison camps, army garrisons, or construction camps and trailer parks. And then they had another set of space that was the plants themselves that were also fenced off and guarded. And inside the plants, there were separate areas that were fenced off and guarded so that you could only go to areas that you were allowed to go in, so you didn't know the whole big production story. Now, once you have all these people arranged, how do you keep workers from giving away valuable nuclear secrets? There was the usual way. Security officials made employees sign security oaths and renew them continually. In Richland, to ensure silence, corporate police and FBI agents wiretapped phones, read mail, and cultivated ranks of informers within community organizations and schools. The KGB took similar measures, selection, security oaths, surveillance. This is showing you this sort of compartmentalized space. And they had these sort of warnings all the time. And the Soviets took security one step farther. And for 8 years, residents were locked into this special closed city and were not allowed to leave without permission. So they couldn't see their family members. They couldn't go skiing in the mountains or to the Black Sea for a holiday. They had to stay in the closed city. But these security measures were only the first circle of security. Ironically, I found as I researched this book that the powerful men who were producing the world's first stocks of plutonium spent a great deal of time worrying about homes, schools, and softball teams. I wondered about that. Like Frank Mathias, who worked for the Army Corps, who built Richland, half his diary is about community planning, recreational programs, and housing. Now, Mathias had watched in 1944 450 workers walk off the job a day because they were dissatisfied with their living arrangements. And DuPont made this argument that if we're going to get good workers to come to this remote, godforsaken place, we need to pay them well. And they can't live in apartments and dorms or barracks. They have to live in nice, freestanding houses on large lots, kind of like those nice green suburbs in Delaware, where the DuPont officials all came from. And so they started to design these houses. And here's Richland. It looks, if you ever were to go there, and maybe some of you have been there, it looks a lot like a post-war suburb. It looks like you've been there 100 times. You've been there in California, you've been there in Chicago, you've been there in Long Island. But this was built in 1943. So this is sort of the beginning of America's suburbia is happening in this militarized setting. Now, what were these places like? In eastern Washington, they called Richland the Gold Coast. It was a strange place. The federal government owned all the land and the property, and first DuPont and then General Electric managed the city. DuPont hired an architect who designed the houses, the shopping centers, and the residential developments. DuPont built and ran the town hospital, the best in the region, which only workers and their families could go to. DuPont and GE selected businesses, gave them monopolies in town, and then so that they would not gouge their workers, they did price checks. They set prices and checked to make sure that they weren't spending too much or charging too much. They set up a town newspaper and censored it. In the absence of tax revenue, GE allocated federal funds for Richland schools and parks and bus service and hospital. Workers who paid no taxes received 30% more than workers in surrounding counties. And this kind of, all this rubbed locals the wrong way. And a lot of observers, newspaper reporters who came and congressmen who came, they said, what is this place? Is it socialism? Is it fascism? It's government-owned, it's state-run, there's no free enterprise, there's no free press, there's no local government. But people who lived in Richland, they were fine with it. They didn't mind this at all. And they especially loved that white male employees could rent a modern, freestanding house with all utilities and maintenance for $35 a month. They paid a half or a third as much as locals did in neighboring Pasco. Here's a shack in Pasco in the black ghetto. If you were to rent this as opposed to that beautiful house in Richland, you paid $100 a month rather than $35 a month. You had no plumbing. You had a spigot on the street and an outhouse. So it was a great deal, and people loved it. And in fact, the contrast between Richland and the surrounding tiny, dusty railroad towns were stark. Here's Pasco. And across the inland west at this time, little ranch and railroad towns were going bust, all the while that Richland boomed. And I think this inspired this sort of insensitive, irrational love of the bomb. And they still use the mushroom cloud as the town mascot for the high school team. Now, in the Soviet Union, since the 1930s, business leaders had been acutely aware of problems caused by not enough consumer goods and low pay. They had seen strikes and riots because of price hikes and shortages of consumer goods. And they had a terrific problem during the war of keeping people on the job. When goods got scarce, workers tend to take a hike and try to find a job elsewhere. So they, too, saw affluence as a way to secure a labor force, a reliable labor force. And Stalin himself told the director of the atomic bomb program, Igor Kurchatov, he said, you know, Russia is very poor, but surely in Russia a few hundred people can live well. Very well, with their own dachas and their own cars. And he told Kurchatov to go back to the Urals and spend all he wanted on a nice new town. And that's indeed what Kurchatov did. He set out to build not just a bomb, but a wonderful city. And here are some images of this city as it developed. In the southern Urals, people called the residents of this town the chocolate eaters because they had unusual supplies in the post-war period of chocolate and sausage that nobody else in the provinces ever had. And by the early 50s, they had more than chocolate. Kurchatov, that's a statue of him, commissioned Leningrad architects to build secretly in the thick forest excellent modern apartment buildings with electricity and plumbing. They constructed theaters, swimming pools, preschools, hair salons, parks. And best of all, the wages were 50% higher, but best of all, they had these consumer goods. And you can see these shops stocked with plums from Romania and Finnish overcoats and German shoes. One woman remembered, we had the feeling that we had already lived under communism. There was everything in the stores, from black caviar to crab. Now, stocked stores and good housing were an unbelievable luxury in the 40s in the Soviet Union. Outside the closed city were towns that had industrial kind of settlements that had names such as Asbestos and Asbestos II. And workers would finish their shifts, and they would wait in line to buy gray macaroni, and then they would disappear, stooping and coughing into their basement dugouts. In the nearby industrial city of Chelyabinsk in 1948, 200 to 300 people lined up at 3 in the morning to buy bread, and they are still there 24 hours later. So for many residents who came from hardscrabble provincial towns in the Soviet Union or the USSR, residency in Oziorsk or in Richland was akin to winning the golden ticket. It meant a person had arrived in the kind of material comfort and prosperity that few had expected in their lifetimes. Ralph Myrick remembered his childhood in a New Mexico company mining town of packed clay and slag heaps. And when DuPont settled his family into this two-bedroom prefab, his mother broke down in tears of joy. She had never lived in a place so new, so clean, with utilities and plumbing. She had never lived in a place so affordable. Ralph's father hadn't finished high school, and Ralph said his father worried a lot. He worried that the plant would close after the war. He worried that at some point the supply of plutonium would be satiated and the plant would close. He worried that his children would say something, or his wife or he would say something, and he would lose his job at the plant. And everybody knew if you lost your job at the plant, you had a month to move out of town. And Ralph knew that nowhere else with his skills and his education could he live so well as in Richland. Now, in the Soviet Union, the contrast between life in the closed city and life outside was so great that residents used gulag slang. They called the outside world the big world. And it wasn't difficult to lose your place in the socialist paradise either. If somebody drank too much, slept with other men's wives, they took it up in party meetings and threatened people with eviction. If your kid dressed like Elvis Presley, listened to the Voice of America, they would be sent out to a boarding school outside of the town, never to return. There was a big explosion in 1957 in this town, and people got nervous. They saw the fallout going, and they quit their jobs in droves. Several thousand people quit their job. But I found that after a couple of months, letters started streaming in saying, "I was stupid. Please take me back. I can't live out here in the big world." So I think that tells you that sort of these places' charm was so arresting and so seductive that people chose to remain in this Eden even when they realized or suspected they were putting their health at risk. So what I'm trying to say is it took a village or maybe a small city to produce the few kilograms of plutonium necessary for a nuclear bomb. And these cities were prize-winning cities. Richland won prizes for planning and housing and educational achievement. And it really led society in charting out post-war American suburbia. Oziorsk also won prizes for creating what the Soviets had been trying to produce since the 30s, which was a socialist city, a prize-winning kind of city that people could live in communism and prosperity and happiness. But the tranquil prosperity of these places sort of belied the fact that they were fronts in an unannounced Cold War that was going on, and that they were primary targets. It also overlooks the fact that all the while these people were enjoying these places, scientists were quietly contaminating the surrounding environment with millions of curies of radioactive waste. And I want to tell you a little bit about plutonium production because it's the messiest stop on the assembly line for nuclear weapons. A few kilograms of plutonium requires 100 tons of uranium and produces hundreds of thousands of gallons of radioactive waste. From 1948 to 1993, the Mayak and Hanford plants each dumped radioactive waste into the ground, the rivers, the airstreams, as part of the normal operating order. Because the military controlled these plants, knowledge of this dumping was not known by the public, nor were all research and health programs at the plant were pretty much sequestered away. This knowledge did not reach the public, neither in the dictatorial Soviet Union or in the democratic United States. In Richland, medical researchers suppressed evidence that local milk, river fish, sheep in the pastures, and sage in the front lawn registered alarming levels of radiation. They did their research secretly at times. Scientists dressed up as cowboys and went out and tested the thyroids of sheep. They wrote in classified documents that alerting residents to these problems would cause undue alarm and mass hysteria. DuPont set up a safety exhibit to promote an image of well-being and care. And you could go to these safety exhibits. You still can go. And there's lots of bathing beauties and door prizes. In Oziorsk, they took security even farther. They removed the plant and the city from the map. Offer you to try to find it. They banned the words radiation and plutonium, and workers had to guess that they were making nuclear weapons. So what's the effect of living on a radiated landscape and working in plants that were contaminated? It was really the first workers who got sick. And this is the Tcha River. In 1949 in Russia, they ran out of underground tanks to store highly radioactive waste. And so rather than stop production, they decided that we'll just dump it in the river. They did that. They dumped from 1949 to 1951 3.2 million curies of waste into the river. And downstream, 28,000 people were living, drinking from that river, washing with it, bathing in it, and fishing in it. And I'll get back to this river in a bit. Now, the first people to get sick at the plant were workers. Or the first people in general to get sick were workers. And some died, and their deaths were attributed to natural causes. And I found, strangely enough, in the Hanford records, two autopsies, twice. I found two autopsies of one man, and I wondered about that. And one case, a 1952 case, there was a guy who was by the name of Ernst Johnson. He was working at the plant. He was a janitor. He was 45 years old, and he didn't feel well at work, and he went home, laid down on the couch, and died. His wife called the GE-run hospital, and the GE-paid doctor comes over and says, I'll do an autopsy. And the autopsy report says that the man died of an aneurysm. But the wife was kind of suspicious. She had seen on the corpse burns on her husband's arms. The doctor said, I don't know what those were about. Some co-workers came by and said, your husband got dosed at work. We saw it. And then the FBI was following her around town wherever she went. So as she was returning to Chicago for the funeral, and she took the body with her, she dropped the body off at the Cook County coroner and said, what do you think my husband died of? The second autopsy report by the coroner said that this man died of radiation poisoning. You can see the burns on the arms. You can see the damage to the heart. And he said, some important evidence from the body is missing, meaning organs had been removed and put somewhere else. Now, soon after that, in the archive, is a correspondence between this coroner and the Cook County coroner and GE lawyers who quickly flew to Chicago to try to get this coroner to redact and retract his autopsy. He refused to do that, so the GE lawyers went to the Washington State Labor Board in Olympia and got them to redact all information about radiation from this man's autopsy. The wife never got compensation, and to this day, Hanford says that they have no fatalities due to radiation incidents in the whole history of the plant. Now, in the Soviet Union, and these are doctors at the Soviet plant, the plants were built in haste and parsimony by hungry prisoners, and many buildings were really poorly designed for this kind of work. There was no money in the first years for rubber gloves, rubber boots for workers. In one lab, there were not even enough stools, so workers sat on wooden boxes filled with radioactive waste. Doctors had no idea of the kind of doses that their workers were getting because that was classified information, so the doctors were sort of working blindly. And so they learned to study the bodies of their patients, and they studied the blood cells, and they got so they could detect when a person was about to have what they called chronic radiation syndrome, which is a syndrome only found in the Russian Urals so far, which is from long-term exposure to low doses of radiation. And the symptoms are kind of an early radiation aging, organ failure, severe joint pains, chronic fatigue, anemia, diabetes, and other immune disorders. Now, several dozen women who worked at the radiochemical plant came down with this chronic radiation syndrome in the early 50s, and they were young women who had been given a clean bill of health in their 20s when they signed on the plant. 5 years later, they're creeping around, barely able to move, and so they started to treat them and study them, and that's when they came up with this diagnosis. These young women died before they turned 30, and about 23% of the first plant workers were diagnosed with this chronic radiation syndrome. And this got the Soviets really nervous because they needed these trained workers. They were rare, they were valuable, they knew secrets, and they didn't want them going out somewhere and being an invalid. So they started to care for their workers. And one way to care for their workers was to, whenever there was a particularly dirty job at the plant, a spill to clean up, a cracked pipe that was dripping radioactive fluid, some construction work to do on contaminated ground with smokestacks going over it, they called in prisoners and soldiers. These people didn't have to be monitored. They didn't have to wear radiation badges. There was no, as temporary workers, there was no limitation on how much radiation they could get. They worked temporarily. They worked for a couple of years and then moved on, taking with them all kinds of radiation that they had ingested and any subsequent health problems. So therefore, the plant workers look healthier than they really indeed would have been. That it becomes sort of a, because of these temporary workers living in these staging grounds who are never considered nuclear workers, creates this picture of a healthy pink plutonium workforce, and the cities themselves especially. Now, this was just a mirage, but it was a useful mirage. Because people really believed in the safety of their plants. In fact, beyond a few isolated cases and some rumors about glowing in the dark and impotency, There were almost no social movements in either of these places until the 1980s. I found a couple of KGB agents who were whistleblowers in the 60s, but that was it. And that was kind of strange, I thought. And even after Chernobyl and the release of a great deal of documents about both Hanford and Mayak, the residents of these towns still fought against acknowledging the connection between the plutonium plants and any local health problems. And I wondered about that, too. In both cities, these residents counted up the number of PhDs, and they were very proud of their education. So why did they agree to live in ignorance for so long? Soviet residents had no electoral politics, no independent media, but the residents of Richland lived in a thriving democracy. Why did the famed checks and balances fail so that a disaster surpassing Chernobyl occurred in America's heartland? And I think the answer to this question lies in these plutopian towns themselves. They were so prosperous, so solicitous, so good at simulating the functions of a participatory society that they proved to be successful incubators of loyalty, patriotism, and a blind faith in authority. And these successful towns also gave the local leaders a lot of credibility. The orderly, universal well-being of family-centered Oziorsk and Richland, where the average age was 26, there were no indigent, no elderly, no unemployed, no crime, gave people a sense of superiority and safety. And the Plutopia residents enumerated their superiority in a lot of different ways. They counted up their higher birth rates, longer life expectancies, higher average incomes and educational levels. They counted how many appliances they had, how they had larger living space and ate more milk and potatoes and dairy products. And they saw these indicators as validation of their towns and of their leaders and of their community's safety. And in some ways, their superior consuming status did keep these people safer. Rather than having to live off the radiated landscape, as did neighboring farmers, people in Richland and Oziorsk purchased their goods from places that came from far away. The milk specifically came from Minnesota to supply Richland. They drank water that was monitored, and the air was monitored too. In the Soviet Union, gynecologists even performed prophylactic abortions if a fetus looked kind of funny. And so that made the birth rate and the infant mortality rate look better than it might have been otherwise. So the assertions that Plutopia residents was healthier were in fact true, because they were younger, more affluent, and had far better health care, but also because as modern consumers, they did not live off the radioactive landscape. And they would say things like, you know, relativize things, the plutonium plant is safer than driving your family car or using your home appliances. Now, in contrast, downstream from the Mayak plant, villagers lived on the radioactive T'cha River. They bathed in it, watered their crops, and cooked with it. And in 1951, plant scientists finally went down and took some readings, and they determined that everyone and everything was dangerously radioactive. They actually stepped away from the children that they monitored because these children were so radioactive. They issued a ban on using the river and told the villagers they could not drink from it or go anywhere near it. But that was impossible because they had no wells. And so the villagers continued to go and draw water from the T'cha River. They also had nothing else to eat other than their own homegrown crops. As the years went by, people in the downstream villages fell ill with cancers, leukemias, thyroid tumors, infertility, and heart diseases. And their children suffered, too, from uncommonly high number of birth defects. Here's if you go around this area and people are selling food on the roadside, all you had to do was put your Geiger counter there. Here I am nervously trying to avoid eating a homegrown meal. The fellow and the boy in the back is about 13 and he had a vocabulary of about 60 words. And this is the next photo I'm going to show you is from a warehouse in Chelyabinsk that was part of the medical research facility where they were testing. They basically turned this village, Muslimovo, on the T'cha River into a natural experiment where they followed medically the three generations of residents on this river to see. They tested their blood every year and they took medical exams. And they also kept a storehouse of babies that didn't turn out. And there's about, I don't know, 500 or 600 of these babies in jars in the one room that I saw. So I'm going to get rid of that photo. Now, the illnesses in eastern Washington were similar in a way. And I would hear the same kinds of stories about these sort of vague complaints that ran through generations. In fact, I just had dinner with a couple of people tonight, and they told me about similar kinds of problems that ran through generations. And then earlier today, I was interviewed by a reporter who grew up in Spokane, and he told me about his entire family riddled with cancers and birth defects, just by the by. I don't know what that is about, but to me, as I worked on this project, the fact that these same kinds of complaints are occurring across the globe in two different kinds of communities that are not in communion with each other was striking. Now, after 1986, when Chernobyl blew the lid off these places, these local farmers started to pop up and say, we're sick, we think, from these plants. And the officials and scientists in both the Soviet Union, Russia at that point, and the United States said that these people were not sick from the plants, that they were sick because they drank too much, they were inbred, they had poor diets, or they just had radiophobia. They just attributed everything to radiation. They said they didn't have chronic radiation syndrome, but they were just chronic welfare cases looking for a handout. And it was easy to discredit the poor farming neighbors of the plutonium plants. The residents of Richland, Azurisk, had long viewed their poor farming neighbors with scorn and condescension. And they saw themselves as the chosen people. And if you didn't make it the grade in the plutonium city, it's because you weren't good enough. So these spatial practices that were set up, the staging grounds and the special cities, appeared to make the natural order look natural. But in fact, they were sort of created, manufactured spatial zones that were set up and then helped make this plutonium disaster invisible in many ways. Now, in Richland in the 1950s, big crowds gathered to see Ronald Reagan sponsor and host the GE Theater. And Reagan demonstrated the total new electric kitchen. And he transmitted the GE-endorsed message that consumer freedom was the cornerstone of democracy. And in Richland, where residents had given up most of their political freedoms, but had a great deal of buying power with all their extra wages, this message especially made sense. Consumerism served as a surrogate for freedoms residents forfeited when they agreed to live in the plutonium city, dependent on one product. By living in Richland, residents took a pass on the rights to self-government, free speech, free assembly, and an independent press. They also gave up control over their bodies as they placed their urine samples each week on the front stoop and sent their kids through whole-body scanners. As consumers, however, Richland residents won back a bit of their voice, lost voice and power. For it was over questions of consumption that they could be the most vocal. And there's big fights about dog walking and leash laws and parking. And these issues seemed trivial, but it was really meant a great deal because it simulated for them the motions of American democracy for which these people were putting their lives on the line. And I say that these people in Richland were not alone. Across the post-war United States, people turned their backs on long-held American values of equal access and opportunity in order to protect their property values in federally subsidized, limited-access suburban communities just off limited-access national defense highways. Richland simply epitomized the post-war inequities, exclusions, and hierarchies of suburbanizing America. There are lots of Americans who are happy to give up their rights and freedoms in order to exchange them for exclusive tickets to their own version of Plutopia. Now, in the Soviet Union, leaders also used consumer prerogatives to keep their chosen citizens happy, and they created, generally across the country, zones of prosperity, and that would be like prime cities like Moscow and Leningrad, amidst greater zones of poverty, and that was the collective farm system. All the whole countryside where collective farmers were made to stay on their farms. They were not allowed to leave, and they lived in dire poverty. So if you were sitting in Azurisk and you only left it for the special resorts reserved just for plutonium workers, The idea that Khrushchev's promise that the Soviet Union would achieve communism and surpass it seemed to be realized. The Soviets had achieved communism, if only in one city, if off the map. And for many people, the consuming superiority of their lives in Oziorsk spoke to them of the superiority of the Soviet Union in general and of the communist experiment. And so people really believed in the Soviet Union. They were loyal and patriotic to it in quite genuine ways. As much as you hear about dissidents in the Soviet Union, there were no dissidents in Oziorsk. In the 1970s, they took polls, and they found that the young generation were even more hawkish and supportive of the nuclear establishment than their parents. In 2000, they took a vote and said, do you want to get rid of the gates and the fence around the city and the checkpoint with the guards? Overwhelmingly, they voted to keep the guards and the gates and remain in a state of sort of a gilded cage. They wanted to keep the riffraff out, they said. So in conclusion, I think the most important element to keeping the secrets of the plutonium disasters was the cultivation of these thriving consumer cultures. In both cities, blue-collar workers were paid and lived like the middle classes, and in a way that their allegiances shifted upwards towards their superiors and their bosses. By zoning territories into zones of privilege and zones of poverty, it kept alive for Soviet urbanites the myth of socialism, just as white affluent suburbs maintain the mirage of universal opportunity in American democracy. In these highly controlled zones of privilege, the space for questioning authority narrowed greatly. Now, zoning off these areas also created an epidemiological mirage that nuclear production was safe. In the plutonium cities, the exchange of political for consumer freedom led to unannounced plutonium disasters, and we've yet to really digest the environmental, genetic, and social impact of that process. So to finish up, I just want to leave you with one last photo. It was taken in Oziorsk in 2000 at a school, and it's a school play.
And the school photo features some obviously disabled children.
And I think this photo illustrates one of the major findings of geneticists working in the late 40s in the United States. And they said quite clearly that the lasting effects of radiation would be genetic mutations that would strike especially the third generation of offspring to be exposed. And I think you can see from this photo how the welfare states that created plutonium cities also produced people who became welfare cases themselves.
And I followed a Q&A, which I condensed slightly to fit it in, but I'll link to the video from this show's webpage, so if you want to hear the full Q&A, you can go to unwelcomeguests.net/676 and follow the link.
Do you see a parallel between America that you are living in today as a whole versus this elite group being bribed by this lifestyle to keep a secret and even give away their own freedom? And you keep saying American thriving democracy. Do you really feel in today's America that we have a thriving democracy? And do you see a parallel between Monsanto creating all the genetically modified foods that are nobody knows really what they are doing to us? Do you see a parallel between your research versus America that you are living in today?
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to point out, when I say thriving democracy, I mean that rhetorically. That's a rhetorical device to get you to question it. I think there's real problems with creating these sort of zones where the federal government and the biggest welfare program in the United States, in the history of the United States, is subsidizing post-war housing for people who could get the loans. And who could get the loans? Straight white families until about the 1980s. And well, to this day, there's a real inequity in who can get loans. And if you're white, you can get a loan. And that loan is subsidized by the federal government. And then your entire infrastructure and the roads that take you there are subsidized by taxpayer dollars, leaving behind people in blighted areas in inner cities to live in poverty and generations of poverty. That choice was made in the post-war period. And I guess I'm trying to point out that those kinds of choices, the kind of choices people made in Richland, which now we look back on and go, oh, my God, we were all kind of making those choices. Lots of Americans were. And And so this notion of national security and then financial security are foremost before the security of our bodies. And I think that speaks to your Monsanto question. As long as it makes money and offers financial security, okay, those are our priorities.
Hi, good evening. My name is Russ Walker. I work at King 5 Television. I've been working with a reporter there, Susanna Frame, on a series of stories, on Hanford, on a particular issue out there. And one thing that really surprised me about your talk tonight and the boosterism and the pro-Plutopia communities is how much it's not really that changed today. The boosterism in Richland is just as intense. They're outright hostile to a free press. In fact, we've offered our coverage of Hanford to the TV stations in Richland. They won't take it. And the newspaper reporter there has never acknowledged any of our reporting, which is I'm very proud of, and it's very much exposes the sort of cavalier attitude that I think the government and the industry there have about people. So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Thank you.
Nuclear weapons are still being produced and refurbished today, although at a lower rate in the Cold War. Have the conditions around the production of that nuclear material or the refurbishment of the weapons improved over what we might have seen in the 70s and 80s?
I wish I could say it had. No. We're spending more now on nuclear weapons than at the height of the Cold War. That's one thing. We all have this illusion that the Cold War is over, and so we stop producing nuclear weapons and spending money on nuclear weapons. That's not the case at all. Maintaining the existing massive stockpile is extremely expensive, and they're designing new kinds of sets of weapons. And no, I mean, I don't know if you caught that story about Oak Ridge, where the three activists about a year ago decided to make a point, and they were sort of religious activists, and one was a nun, and she was 82 years old, and they had some wire cutters, and they went at night into this Oak Ridge, which is the biggest stockpile of uranium in the country, and they cut through four fences, and were able to put graffiti on the walls of this Fort Knox of uranium before they were caught by the security officials 3 hours later. So what the DOE, the Department of Energy, says is, you know, we give the job to our contractors, we're proud of our contractors, we trust them, and then we don't worry about oversight and regulation. Government regulation is bad. So they're leaving these contractors to make millions of dollars in bonuses, and they're not really watching what they're doing. So there's a great inflation and a very low quality control going on in the nuclear industry in general.
This is really a comment instead of a question. I was part of Nixon-Brezhnev Accords a few times in 1970. In 1975, we had a meeting. It was on water quality. And there was a person, I'll just give his first name, David, who was an oceanographer. And he kept trying to come get me aside and was telling me, my Russian still isn't very good, wasn't perhaps better then, about this incredible place in the Urals, about this disaster that happened in 1957, and that people were kept in, were fenced in, and he says, you wouldn't believe people in their 20s and 30s are dying and their teeth are missing and they have this incredible incidence of cancer. He eventually himself died of cancer, but he got out of the Soviet Union. He was an oceanographer. Uh-huh. Yeah, and every time he'd start telling the story, and I said, am I understanding what he's saying? I was doubting. It was just seemed so grotesque and frightening. And every time, then someone would come, supposedly
a translator.
And right away he would talk about what to eat and so on and so forth. Totally changed the subject.
Wow.
So.
Thank you.
I'm very curious about how long you worked on this book and how you got the information in Russia. And do you speak Russian? And were you able to get these stories?
I worked on the book for 6 years, and I speak Russian. And there was an archive in the steel town of Chelyabinsk that had the party records for this closed city. I could never enter the closed city. But the closest I could get was a little village outside, and I had a little hut that I borrowed from a friend, and I had no electricity or running water, and I was chopping wood, and and taking a sauna and everything. But I did have a cell phone, and so that when the cell phone would ring, it was I had a contact inside the closed city who would call me and say, I'm sending someone out to you to talk to you for interviews. And so then we would go to a third neutral location, and I would talk to these people. And some people would meet me, and they'd say, where are you from? They'd hear my accent, and I'd say, I'm American. And they would just turn around and go out the door. But others, mostly women, were courageous enough to talk to me and tell me their story, and that helped a great deal. And then, in the American case too, the people like Ed and Cindy were forthcoming, but not a lot of people in Richland wanted to talk to me very openly about what was going on. I felt a similar kind of ice quality to a lot of the interviews I carried out in the States.
My name's Ed Bricker. I was a whistleblower at the Hanford nuclear site. My grandfather worked there in construction. My other grandfather worked there as a security guard. My dad worked there as an electrician. I went to Richland High School, was a Richland bomber. Grew up breathing the air, drinking the water, swimming in the river, and basically believing in the defense work that we were doing at Hanford. I worked out at the site, was one of the first whistleblowers at Hanford. I worked undercover for Senator John Dingell's committee, or Congressman John Dingell's committee, working with Jeff Hodges. And then I worked with Bob Alvarez, who was a staffer with John Glenn's committee. I had to do that in order to protect myself because I was concerned about waste, fraud, and abuse at the nuclear site, environmental issues I saw. I was one of the first workers to complain about having my lungs exposed to tank vapors at the site. And I since have been diagnosed with COPD and asthma as a result of breathing those vapors. I also had tank waste splashed on my arm and leg and developed cancer as a result. And I'm still in a protracted battle with the Department of Labor and basically the Department of Energy over these exposures. And at the time, I was called crazy and made a lot of fun of because of, in particular, those lung exposures that I had at Hanford. It's still a production first, safety second mentality at Hanford, but now it applies to cleanup. I also was hired by the state of Washington to regulate the Department of Energy and the nuclear sites in Washington and suffered severe harassment as a result of my bringing up safety concerns with my management, in particular building of facilities that I thought were improperly designed. I wrote a letter to Governor Gary Locke that was lost, and I believe my concerns at least were never adequately addressed. I complained about the design of the current blastification facility there. I have some very real concerns, like former Presidents Truman and Eisenhower, about the military-industrial complex and how it oversees these facilities, these ex-production facilities that are now in Cleveland. And I believe that contracts are often rewarded to maintain long-term relationships with these companies. For instance, when the B-1 bomber program was winding down, Rockwell was rewarded with the contract to oversee Hanford. And under Rockwell, I suffered tremendously and I believe was retaliated against for voicing concerns about waste, fraud, and abuse and environmental problems at the site.
Now, for our second hour, we hear Tony Gosling speaking on the 13th of October, 2012, at the Awakened State Conference in Edinburgh.
What I'll be talking about today is really some of my experiences in journalism that have led to taking a very dim view of the modern mainstream media. I'm also an activist within the National Union of Journalists in the new media side. And, you know, we're campaigning amongst journalists for more truth-seeking in journalism. And I would stress, it's very easy to blame journalists, just like it's easy to blame politicians, particularly after the expenses scandal. What we forget is that many of those who were some of the worst abusers of expenses, such as Tony Blair, the information about them for some reason never appeared. Oh, we've lost the information for Tony Blair. The same, in a way, is true with journalists. You know, you get a little bit of some and not the others, because what's going on there is that it's not the journalists that control what's actually going out. It's the own, and we often forget, it's the owners of the transmitters, who, by the way, in this country for the BBC are Siemens, the last time I knew, and it's the managers and the editors that make the decisions about whether the journalists' information is going to get out there to the public. So I suppose the theme of this afternoon for me is really to do with this word context. If you're not putting the news into context, you're not actually understanding what's going on as a journalist, as an editor, or as an audience. And I'll take a few positions now. One of those is that I don't believe that the Nazis were defeated in the Second World War. I believe they always planned to use the loot that they'd not looted from Europe to set up a kind of financial network. And I'll be talking about that a bit later. And this is one of those basic things that I think so much of the mainstream press has got wrong. And I'll be putting forward some evidence to support that. We've got a kind of poisonous legacy from the Second World War, which is haunting the Western world. I mean, we've seen this in certain films, like things like the Odessa File books as well. And I'm sure you've all got your favourite sort of, oh, the Nazis survived the World War II films. But this is hinting at something which is actually really quite sinister. And if anyone's as old as I am, they may even remember the 1970s film by World in Action from Granada and Manchester, where they followed around the Nazis in South America and actually were tracking down and talking to the people from the Mossad. But we'll go into that a bit more later. I think there's a load of psychology involved in this as well. We've been talking about this a little bit earlier on today. The big lies. What that does is it disengages the public from the political process and also from the media. And it induces apathy. If you think that what's been going, you know, that the mainstream dialogue is lying, and that there are all sorts of lying positions in there, such as the position which even some of the Tory cabinet take, is that they want to deal with the problem of tax havens, where most of their own personal wealth is in those tax havens. And when David Cameron's father, Ian Cameron, was the pioneer of tax havens, when the exchange controls were lifted in the early 1980s, then you start to lose any kind of faith that there's any real debate going on. And this is repulsive. What it does is it just disengages us from that. And this is very dangerous, very pernicious. The prize, I suppose, in the media is that this is the nervous system for humanity. And increasingly it's global. I mean, Russia Today, for example, is a global channel, the BBC World. They are a global channel. And this is the nervous system by which we function. You know, this is what controls the limbs of the body politic, if you want. And when that's poisoned in the way that so much of the mainstream media is today, with false debates being put forward, people being allowed to lie without being held to account, then, you know, we are in a serious problem with humanity. And I talked about the Second World War, but this is like almost like a curse that won't go away. The First World War, you know, we thought that was it back after that. The war to end all wars, of course. Then it came back, but it still hasn't gone away. It's a language most people understand, to use that word, the curse that won't go away. Today it's haunting us in the form of what's happening in the Middle East and also with the financial crisis, and we'll talk about that a bit more later. This is one thing as a journalist. I mean, as I decided to get into journalism, I suppose it's a bit like Icarus. The closer you get to the sun, you start to realise, well, actually, some of these people who are running things, when you're meeting cabinet ministers and interviewing them, there's something wrong. These people are one person when they're being interviewed. They're someone else. As soon as you switch the tape recorder off, they've got a quite, you know, actually sinister personality, many of these people that I met. Whilst working in London, and I was only working in local radio as a researcher and a reporter in London, and it was a strange thing because we were working in London. We had Greater London Radio, where I was in the early 90s, had a very massive audience for our lunchtime and drive time programmes, but also we were doing a lot of national and international stories, which is very rare for anyone working in local radio. So I was very privileged, and that journey. You get to a point where you realise, look, what's more important? Is it my career or the story? And I didn't really have much of a choice in my own heart there, because I could see that there were lots of stories that weren't being told. And so I decided I'm going to pursue these stories wherever they lead. And I think that takes a little bit of courage to say that to yourself, is even if this goes somewhere rather dark, rather like the public who are repelled by lies they see, by evil that they see in politics and in the mainstream news. You know, that also, journalists have that feeling too. You know, we were also repelled by that, and we think, well, actually, I'd rather go around that story. But actually, what I decided to do was to really to bite the bullet. And we mentioned the Second World War a little bit there, but Churchill said, "History will be kind to me, I know, because I will write it." And that starts me thinking about maybe we shouldn't be quite so kind to someone with that sort of arrogance. I mean, you know, there were wonderful things that the British did. We had David Cameron this week at the Conservative Party conference talking about, and I don't know how many people actually bothered to listen to his talk, but he actually said several things which just, to me, are complete nonsense. One of the key ones was, we beat the Nazis. Actually, it was the Russia Today types that beat the Nazis. Far more casualties than the Americans and the British combined and the French, you know, altogether. It was Stalin's war machine going up against Hitler's war machine that was really at the core of the European front in the Second World War. And so this kind of, you know, it's rather like when George Bush said something similar about the Americans winning World War II. You know, everyone wants to be the one credited with beating the Nazis. And there is a key thing with the Nazi empire and with the Nazi philosophy, which is part of that curse, which wouldn't go away. I don't think anybody's ever managed to create a system, at least that we know of, that was so pernicious. So what I'd like to do is spend about a quarter of an hour going through some what I think are important points of history. This is talking about going back to that idea of context, important points in history through the years, which we're really not made aware of. And the theme that runs through these is really two things, which is land and money. Land, because the land is a free gift to humanity, and yet if you want to buy a little piece of land out there or you want to use a little piece of land out there, you're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds to even start thinking about it. We're also in a situation now where many of our buildings are empty. They're just used as investments because there's low interest rates out there in the markets. And land is now being used as just a commodity that people invest in. They don't necessarily use it. I mean, we've got landowners, massive landowners, many of whom have got estates of thousands of acres that they've never even visited, never even seen. And land has become a commodity which needs to be shared out again. And it's great to see that in Scotland there has been this quite powerful land reform movement, and people like Andy Whiteman, people may have come across, who have been writing about the history of land up here. His book, if you haven't come across it, is an absolute must-read for history, for Scottish people. I don't want to lecture you too much on this, but it is called The Poor Had No Lawyers. And it talks about the clearances, and it talks about the absolute horrific abuse by the aristocracy, who were learning tricks from the English as to how to mistreat poor people up in Scotland. And the other is money. Okay, talking about money, we could kind of start with the Roman invasion, really. Obviously, that didn't make its way up here, but it did make a big difference in the southern half of Great Britain, where this whole idea of money was kind of something quite new. There was ways of trading. People were exchanging things. The idea was originally that certainly that the land was not ownable. This was a resource which had to be used by everybody, and so therefore it had to be shared out. And the same was true with various types of wealth. Obviously, there was fighting going on amongst some people, but the idea that someone could be denied anywhere that they could stay was really only something which took place in battles between, you know, one tribe or another tribe, or maybe when the Vikings invaded, this kind of thing. No, that's not your land. People will be fighting each other for land. So that was the introduction of money, effectively. We've got a situation with roughly 60 million acres in Great Britain and roughly 60 million people. And many of us are asking ourselves the question right now, where's my acre? Because when you've got the land, as the Crofters have done, you don't need to be actually using the land. It's just the fact that you've got it. If you're not, you may be working in IT and commuting, but if you've got that land, you can then rent it out to your neighbours. You've got a basic resource. Now, the Green Party, for example, are talking about this thing called a basic income. And effectively, it's the same thing as having the right to land. So the idea is that everybody needs these kinds of basic resources. And that what we're seeing now with benefit cuts in Britain, I noticed the Scottish have rejected this company Atos and said that they're not going to be doing any of these benefit assessments in the future up here. But we still have to cope with them back in England and Wales, unfortunately. This is actually what these benefits are, is compensation for stolen land over history. Now, you see what I mean by context. If you don't understand the context of stolen land taken away at sword point, knife point, you don't understand why you've got these mass numbers of unemployed people, and you simply cannot blame people who are unemployed, who are disabled, who don't have any resources, for claiming benefits, which is just compensation for stuff that's been stolen from them. With the Vikings, the Normans, the centralisation of power really starts. This is 1086, the Doomsday Book. I mean, do people know where the word the Doomsday came from? This is 1086, not long after the Norman invasion. I'd just like to sort of gauge audiences where you. I mean, anyone like to shout out? Judgment Day. Absolutely right. Thank you for being brave. Judgment Day, because the idea was once this had been drawn up, this was an inventory which was drawn up right across England, and everywhere then had to produce a tax on land, a tax of resources every year. Otherwise, people would be in jail. There was no appeal. That was the idea, that this was absolutely set in stone. And as the commissioners were going round after the Norman invasion, collecting all this information about the land and the resources, there were riots in some places. These commissioners were attacked. Some were injured. As far as I know, there were none killed. But the people were saying, a bit like we are now with the Big Brother Society, we don't want this invasion of our privacy. We would rather run our own affairs. We want a soft-touch government, not a hard-touch Big Brother state. And that's in a weird way, you know, that's the way they saw this as an invasion of their privacy, an invasion of their own sovereignty. And they could see that this was a slippery slope to centralised control. So then we have, that was 1086, then we have 1118 was the formation of this interesting organisation called the Knights Templar. Now, the Templars, very controversial historically, but there's a couple of things about them which convinced me that there's been a lot of rubbish, a bit like Churchill saying, we are going to write the history. They were a very, very wealthy organisation, and so they've left this kind of legacy through the history. Very positive legacy for a lot of people. They say, oh, the Templars were very badly treated by Philip the Fair. Well, I'll tell you a couple of things about that. First of all, the arrest of the Templars and the torture of the Templars was not the only way that evidence was got about their crimes. And those crimes were pretty horrific. I mean, quite clearly they were not following any kind of Christian religion. There were three whistleblowers back in 1306, a year before the famous arrest of the Templars in 1307 on Friday the 13th of October, Gerard of Vizol, Esquin of Floyan, and Bernard Pellet, three former French Templars who'd gone to the authorities saying, I'm part of this organisation, but I've had enough. This, what they're doing is absolutely appalling and outrageous. And this really shows the lie of that all of the confessions were taken from the Templars under torture, and that they, you know, I'm no fan of torture, quite clearly, but this was more of a normal thing in those days. And it's quite fascinating to know that the initial impetus for this came from whistleblowers who've been largely forgotten, as so many of our whistleblowers today have. You know, they get marginalised by the mainstream press, they get bullied out of their jobs and disappear off into obscurity. We need to value our whistleblowers. The other thing is that the wealth of the Templars was what Philip was really after, Philip the Fair. And that's another lie, because the wealth went to two places, not to Philip. It went to the Knights Hospitaller. They took on a lot of the Templars' property in Malta and land in other places. And it also went to the Pope. So these are two just really important facts about that, which have kind of been buried and lost in obscurity. Then also, talking about land, then Statute of Merton was 1235. That was the first enclosure of private land in England. Now, this was the beginning of the, what eventually led to the clearances, which is this concept which we're now looking at a different strata of that, which is genetic engineering, the privatisation of genetic material, genetic codes, that kind of thing. So that was the beginning of this whole idea of, you know, land privatisation. You know, we get annoyed about the way that we're now subsidising the railways three times more than we did before privatisation, back in the nationalised British Rail days. But this was a whole other strata beyond that, before that. If you go back as far as Leviticus, it's quite clear in the Old Testament, in the Book of Jubilee, it says the land is God's. That's what it says, basically. And you are my tenants. And then it says every 50 years we need to redistribute the land. Now, we haven't done that for quite a while. So it's about time we did. I mean, if we're looking at solving the financial crisis and looking at real security, what people need, what families need, is somewhere where no one's going to come and bang on the door and say, you haven't paid the rent, you're out. Because then what happens is people invest in their own place and they have that sense of real security, not some sort of private security guard knocking on the door or putting a lock on their door. After the Templars were abolished, of course, they had a warning of this. They'd moved much of their wealth. Then, not long after that, in 1348, something called the Order of the Garter was formed. This is the 26 knights who basically surround the British monarchy and the heir to the throne. And that was the idea right from the start, and it's still a very powerful little organisation today. They meet in Windsor Castle. But, you know, there's something suggests to me that there may be a connection between the Templars and the Garter Knights. Certainly they were both these sort of chivalric orders, very shrouded in secrecy, all people who were very generally very wealthy or powerful in one sort or another. And it's a way of kind of keeping it in the family, if you want. I don't know how many people were shocked as I was to hear the big news story with Frank Gardner, the BBC's royal correspondent, talking about how the Queen had phoned up David Blunkett or spoken to David Blunkett face to face and said, this guy, Abu Hamza, you know, why hasn't he been arrested? What is the Queen doing? Is she a figurehead or is she instructing a Secretary of State for the Home Office who to arrest and who not to arrest? It sounds very medieval. And I think that we really need to question the reality of the monarchy as some kind of figurehead. I think it's a very powerful force behind the scenes. And one of the places to look when you're looking at that power, of course, is this successor kind of organisation to the Templars, the Order of the Garter. People very often just think, oh, it's just a ceremonial thing. But who are those people? Who are those individuals? And what kind of power do they wield behind the scenes? I think that little story the other week was just a tiny little chink of light into something which is actually much more sinister, in that there are people out there who are very much behind the scenes, pulling the strings. Someone like David Blunkett, you know, the guy's blind. He's signing documents. You know, there is a way of almost taking the mickey, really, that this guy is just a figurehead of some sort and he can be easily manipulated. So, I mean, in terms of land, going forward in time a little bit more, 1535 to 40 was Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries. This was another massive change. Something like 900 monastic institutions were either demolished or taken over by the crown and by people who were loyal to Henry VIII. Now, that actually meant something like 10,000 monks and nuns sort of kicked out, lost their jobs. But this was a very a big shift in the idea that it was important to have a religious institution, a spiritual institution, if you want. I'm obviously a challenged spiritual institution, controlling much of the land and doing services, for example, hospital-type services that the monks used to offer, and producing food, wine, all that sort of thing. As producers, they were considered to be no good anymore, just as Henry VIII decided that he was going to start his own church because he didn't like what he was being told by the Vatican. So that was another really big change. Of course, that was a big reward. In those days, it was a lot of money. He had about £100,000 extra a year after the dissolution of the monasteries as revenues from those estates. We go on to 1549, that's another few years, to Kett's Rebellion. Now, this rebellion what happened in Norfolk was a massive rebellion, and this was all against privatisation of land. These were the people who were, I suppose, trying to stop this. What they could see was the pernicious progress of this land privatisation, which ended up up here in the clearances and the Battle of the Braes up in Skye. But there were people throughout the hundreds of years that the enclosure was going on who were really making strenuous efforts to stop it. And very, I mean, I speak to a lot of, well, it's one of those questions I often ask young people, Kett's Rebellion, have you ever heard of it? No. It was about 6 or 8 weeks. The entire north and most of East Anglia was run from underneath an oak tree by Robert Kett. He was a landowner. When he decided to enclose his land, his estate was surrounded by peasants who said to him, "What are you doing, Robert? You said you would never privatise your land, that this was all going to be common land forever for us all to use." And his answer was simply, "Well, look, everybody else, all my surrounding landowners are privatising, and if I don't, I'm going to end up with nothing. But I'm with you," he said. And he led the revolt for 6 weeks. They actually turned back the king's army that came to put down the revolt. They went round identifying all of the big landowners who'd privatised the land, who'd enclosed their land, and they were brought before Robert Kett and asked to give an explanation. If they didn't give an explanation, which most of them didn't, he locked them up in Norwich prison for stealing the land. Theft. Simple. It's there on the statute book. You've stolen the land, you're in jail. And this was obviously exciting for all the peasants who found that they'd had a champion. So these kinds of little bits of history have often been quite deliberately hidden from us. Then we had the English Civil War in the 1640s, which the Scots had a bit to do with, obviously. But that was the big change, which was from the feudal system over to the merchant classes as the merchants came in. And the feudal classes are still there. We were talking about the Queen earlier on and that whole system. I mean, for example, we've got the Nobel Peace Prize, haven't we, just awarded to the European Union. How strange is that? I mean, who is it at the European Union that is in charge of foreign policy? It's Baroness Ashton. Baroness Ashton's never been elected to anything in her life. She wasn't even elected when she was treasurer of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament because no one else wanted to do it. She also answers to who? She answers to the royal family. She's a baroness. This is a really, I mean, I don't know what's going on with the Nobel Prizes. I mean, they don't seem to be making much sense anymore. Unless the idea is to pin a Nobel Prize, as they did on Barack Obama, to say, you know, wouldn't it be a bad idea if you started a war now? So there may be that side to it. But the whole thing seems very, very peculiar. So anyway, the Civil War, Cromwell beat the feudal class, and I would suggest that one of the main reasons for the English Civil War, and this is something which very few, I mean, I can't persuade a lot of other people who are Civil War scholars because they're so embedded in the traditional idea that ship money and taxes were what was responsible. But what had happened just in the run-up to the English Civil War was that the ordinary people had been being kicked off the land through enclosure again and again and again. And there were a lot of people starving by the wayside, living in hedges, this kind of thing, because they had nowhere to live. They'd been evicted. And what happened was Charles I, to make a bit of money, decided to tax all of the people who'd been enclosing. So if you've enclosed your estate, you've got to pay this tax. That was in the late 1630s. And this tax obviously annoyed all these landowners, who are merchant classes, who were making a lot of money out of privatising land and kicking people off, evictions. One mistake Charles I made was that he made some of these taxes retrospective. So people who'd enclosed when it was legal to do it were finding that they had to pay a fine. Anyway, in my own view, that's why the Civil War happened, is that the merchant classes and the rich landowners decided, we're not having this. And they then started organising against the king. But anyway, so the merchant classes, the City of London effectively then took over control of England. One of the first things they did was, in 1694, the incorporation of the Price Bank of England. So another important aspect to all of this was that you've got the idea of banking and money and finances for the country is something which is privatised too, run by private individuals. Now, this is the big problem we've got now, of course, isn't it? Because the Treasury and the Bank of England are trying to do their thing, but all of their quantitative easing and all the various other things that they're doing to try and kickstart the economy has got to go through this airlock called the City of London. And what happens is, well, because we've got a criminal gangster class in the City of London now, none of that money is ever going to get through to the general public and into the rest of the economy. It all gets sucked in by the banksters. And that whole situation started back in, as I said, back in 1694 with the incorporation of the Bank of England. If this government wanted to do anything about the financial crisis, they could very easily allow the banks, the free market approach, to collapse because most of them are running on dodgy accounts, Enron accounting, and they could spend money directly into the economy on infrastructure projects, you know, that kind of thing. A very, very simple thing to do, but you will very rarely hear that idea mooted because it's not what the rich and powerful want. Which, what does that say about the health of our democracy? Now, one of the aspects to all this, I mean, we heard a little bit about Freemasonry before. Freemasonry is very big in Scotland. It's very big in Bristol, actually. And one of the most fascinating aspects to all of this is that it took, and this is the guy, Adam Weishaupt, in Germany, was a professor of canon law in Goldstadt University. And one of the things I found out about this guy, he started this order called the Illuminati. This was like, you know, the biggest scandal of all scandals, like almost, I mean, I'm trying to think which is there really anything? Maybe the MP's expenses scandal or something, you know, which has gone on and on, even though it's been slightly overblown. Back in the late 1700s, everyone was talking about this guy and about his organisation. It was a massive scandal. And it was actually a guy from Edinburgh University, Professor John Robison, that wrote a book called The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe. That was in 1793. He was a close personal friend of James Watt, who's the inventor of the steam engine, you know, the engine of the Industrial Revolution. Robison, ironically, what he was doing with this book was translating from German and French into English all of the pernicious methods of Adam Weishaupt, one of which was that the organisation would always appear under another name. It would never appear under its own name. The organisation would use women, use the wish for women to be emancipated against humanity and flatter the women. All this stuff is laid out in these German writings, which, and he was a fluent German and French speaker, Robison. So I'd recommend if you're interested in what went wrong with Freemasonry back in the late 1700s, this is the guy to read. And it's a very readable book. But the irony is, I mean, this is really a message to us down through history about power and about how it can be abused by cults. And that's what we were dealing with the Nazis, wasn't it? I mean, we're still dealing with this kind of thing with Scientology and other cults that are in our society. Freemasonry is a religious cult. But I think in Robison's day, it was largely a benign organisation that was a kind of speakeasy where people didn't have to be quite so formal as they did in ordinary society in that way. So the irony really was that he was the inventor of the siren. In a way, sounding his siren through history to us, saying, listen to this and don't forget about it because this organisation is storing up trouble for the future. Now, I have absolutely no idea whether an organisation calling itself the Illuminati exists today, but certainly those ideas of using cults and secret societies to infiltrate positions of power is absolutely rife, I would suggest. I mean, I've seen it in our own city, you know, with one of our Masonic MPs who's been promoted, even though at the local city council he was known as the invisible man. He never turned up for council meeting. But suddenly he's made an MP. In fact, he's made an MP in one of the most important constituencies in that whole part of the country because there's a big privatisation of an airport going through, Filton Airfield. And this is the sort of, you know, you could see little glimpses of where these secret societies, where these cults are pernicious. So one of the things that Robison talks about in his Proofs of a Conspiracy is this conference which took place in 1782 at Wilhelmsbad, which was essentially where the whole of Freemasonry was converted into this kind of illuminated Freemasonry. At least that was the attempt. Then we go on to the French Revolution. And one of the things that the horror writer and Second World War deception planner Denis Wheatley says is that the French Revolution was a long-term retribution for Philip the Fair's attack on the Templars. That what actually happened in the French Revolution was all of these aristocratic bloodlines that were connected with Philip the Fair were put in the guillotine. You know, there's a very direct connection between the two. This was one of those long-term grudges you sometimes hear about. The other thing about Weishaupt is that he was ostracised in Germany. The guy was on the previous slide. He was ostracised in Germany. He was exposed, went underground. But he was given a pension and a room and a library by none other than the Duke of Saxe-Gotha. So many of you will know that this is the same family that have given rise to our present monarchy, the Saxe-Coburg family. And they had to change their name in the First World War because of these Gotha bombers coming over. They thought that was a little bit bad for their PR. Anyway, getting on to some of the nitty-gritty with land. How much do we pay for our rent? This is another question which is very much more up-to-date, and I'll just take a little excerpt for this. A six-bedroom house costs around about £1 a week. That's what it should cost. Now, you're looking at me, what are you talking about? The labour cost is around about 800 man-hours to build a house. That's the labour cost. The material costs about 700. That's 1,500 man-hours to build the house. At £10 an hour, that's £15,000. So why is it, and if you assume that the house lasts for 200 years, that's about £1 a week. Why is it we're paying so much more than that? Isn't that one of those weird things that you think, well, because it's a racket. There is the mortgage companies, and there's also the people who own and buy and sell land that are taking their cut from all this, and, of course, the private landlords. But just bear that in mind. If you're talking about actually just building a house that's going to last for a couple of hundred years, several generations, you should be paying £1 a week rent. One of the things I've been looking into as well to do with the Bilderbergs, and we'll come to them now. The Bilderberg Conference started in 1954, but just in the last year or so, I've been doing some research with various people who've come to me with information about this, and I find it fascinating that the guy that started all this, and this is one of the things that piqued my interest about the Bilderberg conferences, this elite conference that takes place once a year in Europe and the US. It'll be in Europe, so you can have a chance to visit it this year, probably. Next year, sorry. It was the involvement of this guy, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Now, Prince Bernhard, he was a particularly nasty chap in that he lied and lied about whether he was a Nazi or not. And then eventually, it was in his biography that he was actually in the SS. And this is the guy who was the first chairman of these Bilderberg conferences. The other person involved was a Freemason, Joseph Rettinger. But the thing that, as we've dug out over the last year or so, was the involvement of two Bilderberg people in the complete disaster of Operation Market Garden, which was the biggest airborne operation in history in September 1944. We had Bernhard, as many people would say, a Nazi spy, in Whitehall in the planning of Operation Market Garden. So, presumably, feeding information about the exact plan straight to the German High Command from inside Whitehall. And the other person involved is Lord Carrington, because Lord Carrington was sitting in a tank as part of the Grenadier Guards, and he was the chairman that took over from Prince Bernhard when Bernhard was caught taking a bribe of $1 million to buy Lockheed Starfighters. Carrington was the guy who, along with the tanks at Operation Market Garden, failed to go down the road to Arnhem. If you've ever seen the film A Bridge Too Far, there's an incident with, I think it's Ryan O'Neill, Robert Redford, where he has a shouting match with the Brits. He says, go down the road. Well, I actually spoke to the guy that said that, because they're basically sitting around making tea, yeah, while the British are dying in Arnhem, just down the road. And I spoke to the guy in the US, Moffat Burrows, who's still alive. He said, I went up to Carrington and I pointed my Tommy gun at him and I said, get down the road now or I'll blow your bleeping head off. And this is the Americans that had just taken the bridge. Carrington had driven his tank across the bridge and then decided to stop and have a cup of tea. So there are a couple of reasons why that might be significant, in that many people say that the failure of that operation meant an extension of the war. Now, we're back down now to talking about the Nazi continuity networks and the opportunities that the Nazis then had to take the wealth out of Germany, the looted wealth from Europe, to South America, and it extended that period of time that they had to do that. So this is the Bilderberg organization going almost rewind. And the weirdest thing about that all was that the Bilderberg conference, the very first conference, took place in a hotel in the exact perimeter where that battle was being fought, in Oosterbeek, which is just a peripheral little town around the outside of Arnhem, which was the main place where Market Garden was fought. And the Germans at the time called it the Hexenkessel, which is the witch's cauldron, because they had these British troops surrounded, and they, for days and days, were just pounding them with all sorts of artillery, rockets, and it really was what you might call a slugfest. It was massacre. And that was the place where they chose to hold the first Bilderberg meeting. I think the best way to finish is really by running you through some of these Nazi continuity characters. This is one guy. Does anyone recognise him? Because Prince Charles is one of his biggest fans. He was the Nazi armaments minister and architect, Albert Speer. If anyone has never seen it, there's a brilliant Jonathan Meade's programme about the Nazis called Jerry Building. And it is unbelievable. When the BBC released the Jonathan Meade's collection on DVD, it wasn't in there, because it is way by far the best thing I think Jonathan Meade has ever done. And he makes a reference to a sideswipe at Charles for being such an admirer of this Nazi architect. And he spends the entire programme really taking apart Nazi architecture. So that's Speer for you. The next character is Rudolf Hess. Now, Adolf Hitler, as all nasty characters, always likes to have sort of several deputies who are vying for his attention, and Hess was one. The other one was Martin Bormann. Hess did this kind of mercy mission up here to Scotland, didn't he, that many people know about, where he was actually quite seriously trying to negotiate with the British to have some kind of ceasefire so they could join forces against the Russians. And he got nowhere with that, which was great for Martin Bormann, because Martin Bormann was then the unchallenged favourite of Hitler. So here's Bormann. He was, you know, Hitler's deputy. He was the second in command. And he was charged with taking over from Hitler when Hitler finished. Now, there are all sorts of rumours about what happened to him at the end of the war, as there were with Hitler. Hugh Trevor Roper wrote the story of what happened to Hitler. I've some serious questions about whether there was whether Hitler survived the war. I think he might quite possibly did, because Hugh Trevor Roper was an MI6 guy who really saw history as something you just made up as you went along. He died recently, by the way. And so this continuity network was started by Bormann after the war. He was taken across to South America. And there's very little good information on this, but one book stands out above all others, and that's this. And some of what we do as journalists really is just about reading the right book at the right time. And this, for me, was absolutely the right book. Paul Manning worked for CBS News in the US during the Second World War. And what he did was, after the war, in 1982 or 1981, he sat down and, with his own money and 2 years of his life, decided to write this whole story down about the financial network which the Nazis had put together in South America. Bormann set up 750 businesses. He was an administrator, basically, in different countries around the Western world. And in those businesses, he invested the looted money from Europe. On the boards of those companies, he put former SS people in, you know, without their swastikas on, but in nice suits. And also gave them sort of, you know, a mission to take over one particular part or another. You know, they were all set out on an economic mission. And in my view, this is what we're dealing with today in many ways, is this succession of very, very, almost as powerful, if not more powerful, say, than a tank division is a business that comes in and takes over your area. I mean, we've had, for example, Kraft come into Bristol recently and take over what was the Cadbury's chocolate factory. They've just completely decimated a large part of our employment in the area. They promised that they were going to keep the factory open. As soon as they took it over, they closed it down. These kind of economic networks, I think, are extremely powerful. And, of course, if you've got these people in the banking sector, then you've got some really serious problems. And I would link this in with the Bilderberg, secret kind of Bilderberg networks too. One of the things that is really important to point out about what happened in South America and what happened after World War II was the complete failure of the British and the Americans to pursue war criminals properly. A lot of those war criminals were seen as actually very, very useful in the new fight against the Soviet Union. And the only people in the late 50s and early 60s who were doing anything about Nazi war criminals, and some of the most pernicious people on the planet, were the Israelis, was the Mossad. They were very active in South America. And Issa Harel was the leader of a snatch squad from the Mossad who tracked down Adolf Eichmann. I'd just like to read a little quote from that Paul Manning book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. This book, by the way, just after it was published, the publisher had his kneecaps broken, and the author's son was shot dead in New York. His first son, his second son, is still alive, I believe. So much emphasis is placed on select Jewish participation in Bormann companies that when Adolf Eichmann was seized and taken to Tel Aviv to stand trial, it produced a shockwave in the Jewish and German communities in Buenos Aires. Jewish leaders informed the Israeli authorities in no uncertain terms that this must never happen again, because a repetition would permanently rupture relations with the Germans of Latin America as well as with the Bormann organization and cut off the flow of Jewish money to Israel. It never happened again, and the pursuit of Bormann quieted down at the request of these Jewish leaders. Bormann's residing in an Argentinian safe haven protected by the most efficient German infrastructure in history as well as by those whose prosperity depends on his well-being. So, in other words, to paraphrase Paul Manning, money talks, Nazi money talks, and it can even buy the Israeli leadership. And that's what happened, because Issa Harel was then sacked from his job after he'd managed to capture Adolf Eichmann, and there was no more real pursuit of the Nazi war criminals by the Israeli state. So this was a bit of a revelation to me, that there'd been so much actual documentation of what had happened after World War II with that looted Nazi money. Before we finish, I'd just like to sum up with a few sort of stories from more of the present day, I suppose. First of all, the lack of talking about Operation Gladio. Every terrorist attack in Europe should be put in the context of this NATO operation, where NATO operatives, fascists who were recruited by NATO, were blowing up things and blaming it on whoever the enemy was at the time, usually the Russians or the far left, left wing, people like the Red Brigades, even potentially many people will say the IRA. We certainly don't know for sure who planted the bomb in Birmingham that the Birmingham Six went down for, the Guildford Four. These were miscarriages of justice, but who planted those bombs? There was an organisation being run by NATO. I mean, we hear now, don't we, about Colonel Gaddafi killing his own people. What about NATO killing us, ordinary innocent civilians here in Western Europe, in order to blame it on whoever the bad guys are at the time? So that was in the 1980s. Then we saw briefly with P2, the P2 Lodge, when the parliamentary investigations into Gladio took place in Italy, we saw there was a shadow government going on where the police chiefs and heads of business were meeting up to decide what the government of Italy was going to do behind the scenes, even kidnapping the Prime Minister, Aldo Moro. Shadow government, absolutely exposed. If anyone doesn't know about the P2, have a look at that. We've had the big lie, which I don't really need to go into, the 9/11 with Building 7 collapsing into its own footprint, no plane hit it, rigged with explosives. The rise of the private military companies. People say the government do these things. I don't think they do. I think this is companies like Blackwater and XE carrying out these kinds of operations for profit. They were touting around on their website, I saw a couple of years ago, we are the best nuclear war fighting organization in the world. We have all the tactics for you if you buy our services. Now, this privatisation of the military is exactly what Orwell warned us about back in the 1940s and 1950s. I suppose the way to finish, maybe, on the Bullingdon Club, because we've got a situation now with a whole bunch of people from an Oxford society, some would say a secret society. You're certainly not allowed to know who the members were. We see some photographs occasionally in the Daily Mail, with people airbrushed out of those photographs. Certainly the people involved in this Bullingdon Club, who seem to have just decided from the word go that they're going to put their own friends into power and propel their mates into power, is Osborne and Cameron. Those are quite key people. Many people don't know that Jonathan Ford at the Financial Times, who's a leader writer for the Financial Times, another Bullingdon Club boy. Nathaniel Rothschild, another one. Very powerful city banker from the banking dynasty. Money coming out of his ears. No problem, of course, with him needing to claim benefits. And another one, we have Boris Johnson, another obvious one. But David Dimbleby. How many people have seen the clip with Boris Johnson actually pointing out David Dimbleby as another Bullingdon Club boy on Question Time? So we're starting to move towards what I think is a really pernicious, what with the royal family making these kind of pressure on government ministers and the Bullingdon Club of millionaires, led by the son of the pioneer of tax havens. If we were to force those with wealth in this country to declare that wealth and to tax it by whatever means, this financial crisis would be over overnight. No problem at all. In fact, even the banks would probably be able to be paid off. The deficit would be gone. But we're led by a man, David Cameron, whose father, Ian Cameron, is the pioneer of making sure that you're not going to get taxed, however much your wealth is. So that's the situation we're in now. It certainly isn't democracy. And the media, as I think, hopefully, I've illustrated for you, is simply not doing its job in calling these people to account. So I'd just like to thank you very much for listening. And now some questions, if you have some.
Tony, thank you very much for connecting even more of the dots. I'm sure more and more people, anybody that's not aware of it, has now understood how today has moved slowly through a process where you can see the links that extend. You touched on the Templars. How far back this goes, none of us really know. We can only make these links and make these guided assumptions of what is going on. But Tony's work is empirical, it's proven. He does have his own ideas, as he says, but his research work, I would advise you to go and have a look at Tony's site, because his research is empirical. And he does.
Can I just say one thing about the book? Thanks for leaving it on there, by the way. The book is actually available free as a PDF. It's one of those weird things, yeah. You know. If you wanted to buy that, it's about £150, £200 for an actual copy of the book. But, you know, it's one of those things that I just think someone somewhere should reprint it. I just don't know if they're going to get their legs blown off or something.
Yes, but, well, you know, well, what happened?
What Paul Manning did by putting this thing together is an incredibly brave thing to do, really. And a single-minded person. And this is why I was talking about journalists. We sometimes get an insight into some pretty dark stuff. And there's a big decision that we all have to make then, is do we share that with the public or do we just shut up and run away?
One thing,
and Paul definitely didn't do that. You can follow what I'm doing and with my colleagues online. We have a weekly two-hour politics program we do on FM in Bristol, but you can pick it up on online and have a listen to the stream sometimes. Yep. I mean, it's actually, what we do is the first hour we talk to a local politician, not about the Illuminati, but about the serious issues affecting the city, such as privatisation. The second hour we float the boat out a little bit. We do a bit more investigative stuff. But that's all at thisweek.org.uk.
Check out Tony's site to get.
If you want to download some of the old shows, or have a flick through and see if there's anything that interests you, any topic.
I'd be really interested to hear what journalistic code you'd recommend. And also, are there journalistic resources for people to go out and do citizen journalism, if you like?
Well, great question. Yeah, journalistic code is the National Union of Journalists Code of Conduct. And the union has been considering the possibility, although this is a bit of a like turning around an oil tanker, actually, of actually allowing bloggers to become members of the union. Because there are people, for example, if anyone knows Craig Murray's blog, Craig Murray is a former ambassador to Uzbekistan. He's a whistleblower. There's a great deal of pressure from the mainstream media in the NATO countries to make this guy disappear or attempt to humiliate him when he comes on to Newsnight very occasionally. There's a couple of figures to do with Craig. 32 times he was phoned by the BBC to come on national TV or radio. 32 times he was phoned back to cancel. Craig's a very interesting guy. He's a blogger. There are some really, really interesting people out there who are able to do the blogging. The thing is, how do you translate that into a national newspaper? What we're facing is some very litigious people out there. But ultimately, you can get this information out, obviously, through the internet. And by putting stuff onto YouTube, you enable a lot more people to at least potentially be able to see it. I don't think there's any real substitute for having a mainstream press, particularly a BBC, which we're all forced to pay for if we want to have a television, you know, some more integrity there. And all this business with Newsnight stopping the piece about Jimmy Savile, for example, has got to be pressed home. I mean, we also had the Holly Gregg piece, apparently, which was recorded for the BBC up here, I think, which was also cancelled. So when we see important pieces of journalism that have been, that journalists have stuck their neck out to make, then cancelled by editors and lawyers, we really need to be asking some questions about our national broadcasters and are they doing their job anymore? Because it seems they're much more interested in listening to the lawyers and to powerful money speaking than they are actually doing their job. And we need to hold them to account and complain as vehemently as we can when we see this kind of censorship, because it's absolutely pernicious. When journalists work on a story, go and interview individuals, they put their lives on the line for those journalists, and then that stuff never appears. This has an absolutely stultifying effect on freedom of speech, and it means that the next time those journalists will think twice, well, is it really worth it, because we may not actually get it out. Catherine Gunn, you might remember a few years ago, she was a worker at GCHQ and in Cheltenham, and she went to The Guardian with some evidence that the Americans were trying to fix a Security Council vote in the run-up to the Iraq War. So she went to The Guardian with this printout that she sneaked into her pocket and taken home. Now, the wait for her between handing it to The Guardian and the thing appearing in The Observer, as it happened, about a month later, she said was one of the most horrific times of her life, because it could have gone either way. You know, if this thing hadn't appeared in the paper, what would have happened to her? I mean, she's taking on some of the most ruthless people on earth. I mentioned the blogger Craig Murray. I'll try not to make this too long an answer. I mentioned the blogger Craig Murray, but when he first reported through the Foreign Office that it was torture was being used in Uzbekistan to extract information from people, which was then being brought back to London and used by MI6 as if it was all factual stuff, to then go into dossiers to possibly arrest people here in Britain and elsewhere. What happened was MI6 turned up at his embassy in Uzbekistan. They sent one of their people and they said, look, Craig, we've got 18 charges here against you, potentially, which we could use in a court of law tomorrow if you don't shut up about the torture business. And incredibly, Craig said, well, I don't want to decide right now. I want to have a week to think about it. The next Sunday, all those allegations appeared in the Mail on Sunday. MI6 had just given all this, basically all this dirt about Craig, all made up, but used through their surveillance of him. And Murdoch was doing the same thing. In fact, he was keeping a whole dossier on loads of political figures and then using it to blackmail them, effectively. So that's what you're up against as a journalist. So sometimes I can see why you might just want to stay as a blogger. You're kind of your own boss. And then every now and again, you might do something which you think may be able to get into the mainstream press, phone them up, say, I've got a piece for you, and have a go at getting it in.
I think I'm right in saying, Tony, in the last few years, the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, there's been more independent journalists killed than at any other time throughout history.
Well, quite possibly.
Or in the Vietnam War, etc.
I think the big thing for me I've seen that's changed over the last 30, 40 years is back in the day, when I was a youngster, you would open a Sunday supplement magazine and you'd see photographs from these war zones. Great photographers like Don McCullen, people like that from Northern Ireland, who'd been right in the front line, risking his life to take photographs that we could see in the Sunday Times colour supplement, colour photographs. I mean, nowadays we get none of that whatsoever. And of course, this is one of the first things that Rupert Murdoch and Andrew Neil did when they came and took over the Sunday Times, is they sang Don McCullum.
I just wondered, I'd never heard of the Bonington Club. Is that the UK's equivalent to the Skull and Bones America?
Well, I mean, we had a bit of history, didn't we? We had something called the Hellfire Club back in the 1700s. Funnily enough, the Hellfire Club was based in High Wycombe, near High Wycombe, at Medmenham Abbey, and it consisted of a Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think his name was Francis Dashwood. And these people used to have orgies and all sorts of ribaldry, and they were some of the senior people in the country. They used to disappear into a hole in the ground and do all this stuff. Funnily enough, Dashwood was only Chancellor of the Exchequer for about a year before people rumbled that this guy couldn't do his job. He was cutting too much and the economy was starting to falter, so he was kicked out.
Sounds very much like today, doesn't it?
Sounds a little bit, some echoes possibly of George Osborne. Now, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've got absolutely no confidence in Osborne whatsoever. I mean, he was the oik when he was at Oxford. They called him the oik, and they used to get him to do all the little odd jobs for them, like the little fag run around guy. In fact, when the Bullingdon Club in Oxford they'd have these parties and events, and they would actually, the new members of the club would get blooded. So in other words, they'd come and cut them, spill some blood and, you know, this kind of thing. And they would smash places up. When they smashed a place up, I mean, there's actually some quite interesting stuff about Boris Johnson smashing things up, Cameron smashing things up. These are the guys who were criticising the looters, of course, and the vandals year before last in the riots we saw. Of course, they were rioters themselves. And that particular job Osborne had was to go around the day after to the pub or wherever it was that had been smashed up with a chequebook and say, oh, how much? You know, that's right. So you asked about the Skull and Bones, which is, you know, Anthony Sutton has written some fantastic stuff about it. And if you haven't seen his YouTube, the films of him back in the 1980s from YouTube, they are eerie. You know, quite, it's almost like a modern horror film. But certainly you could compare the two, because the Bullingdon Club is a very secretive drug taking, a lot of, you know, coke snorting, this kind of thing was going on. And these are the people who are now, you know, in the cabinet.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from the MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. The other day I discovered somebody posting these MP3s to YouTube to reach another audience, and of course I was encouraged. So keep doing it, whoever you are. I appreciate your vote of support and your get on and do it attitude. If there's somebody you know who you think might fancy a listen to this show, do pass it their way. Spread the news that there are very important things that we are not told by the television, the newspapers, and the other media controlled by big money. Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
This archival recording is part of a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist. TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Assassination of Julius Caesar, Part 2. Michael Parenti is one of the acclaimed and popular progressive authors and speakers of our time. He can be counted on to give a radical critique of the affairs of the day: globalization, terrorism, or U.S. foreign policy. His recent book explores the death of Julius Caesar, and he applies the same methods, wit, and incisive irony to history that he uses to dissect current events. In part one of the talk, he challenged Julius Caesar's image as a ruthless dictator and reported on the many reforms enacted by Caesar that made him unpopular with those whose privilege he confronted. In fact, Parenti shows that Caesar was only the last in a line of reformers dating back across the better part of a century who were murdered by the Roman oligarchy.
He was killed because he began to infringe on the prerogatives of the aristocracy. He was killed because he canceled rent payments for an entire year. Do you know how much a landlord likes you when you cancel rent payments for an entire year? That doesn't win popular. And most of these aristocrats were landlords. They were slumlords. Cicero was a slumlord. Crassus was the richest man in Rome. Most of his money, well, he had estates. He had merchant trade and all that stuff. But most of his money came from buying up many of the slums. They hated him because he instituted debt cancellation. Suetonius reckons about 25% of the outstanding debt in all of Rome was canceled by Julius Caesar. 25%, one-fourth, that's a lot. You know how creditors feel when you cancel debts on them? They don't like that either. He canceled it because the rates, interest rates were about 45% interest is what you paid on a loan. Another thing he supported was land redistribution. For centuries, Rome had been victualled by the farmers, independent, small, poor farmers working the rich lands of the Campania region around Rome. And the land was publicly owned. It was the agar publicus. It was public land. And the farmers paid a modest rent to the public treasury. And you had these aristocrats not making a penny on the whole thing. All that land was sooner or later expropriated. So there was the move among the reformers to redistribute some of that land. Caesar also did some other things. He argued that every rich landowner who had a slave labor force had to hire one-third of his force as free labor. This would create more jobs for the proletariat. That's what they would call the proletariat. And it would also cut in on the profits of the very rich and give some of it back to the people. Another thing he did was impose luxury taxes and limits on how much wealth can be accumulated. The limits were very generous. So that's why they hated Julius Caesar.
The assassination of Julius Caesar is a story, in Parenti's words, of large land holdings and death squads, masters and slaves, self-enriching capitalists and plundered provinces, profiteering slumlords and urban riots. Featuring corrupt politicians, money-driven elections, and the political assassination of popular leaders. Parenti leaves it to the reader to decide whether any of this might resonate with the temper of our times. Here is Michael Parenti. He begins by talking about the motives and intentions of those who were preparing to kill Julius Caesar.
It's a very funny thing in history, because what you're dealing with here are intentions and motives. And no one's ever seen a motive. Motives are not empirically observable. We only can impute or ascribe a motive. We can never really see one. You see the actions, and then the people who did take the actions give you a profession of what their motive was, and you can accept that or not accept it. You know, I attacked Iraq because it had weapons of mass destruction. That's what motivated me, you see. But you can test it in certain ways. I mean, you can't test it as you could in a laboratory where you say there's a independent variable, a dependent variable, and you hold this constant, you control for that, and oh, that didn't work. Or let's run it through again. This time we'll do another variable. You can't do that in history. It's true. You can't say, hey, let's all do the French Revolution over just one more time, but this time would you please? That doesn't happen. But you can weigh evidence against other evidence, you see. Consider this. The Roman senators, the assassins, killed Caesar because he was becoming a dictator and they wanted to preserve the republic. That's the central view. Okay, how could you test something like that? Here's how you could test it. Very simply, about 40 years before, Rome did get a dictatorship. Sulla came in. Sulla brought an army into Rome, something that was a sacred rule. No general should ever lead his troops into Rome. Sulla came in and he murdered thousands of people. He murdered 50 senators who he felt weren't conservative enough. He murdered 1,000 equestrians. He murdered thousands upon thousands of Democrats and common people. Sulla confiscated land. He wiped out the democratic power of the people's tribunes. He wiped out their power to veto certain senatorial acts. He froze out the popular assemblies. He bypassed them. He gave the Senate pretty much more power than it had in the Constitution three centuries earlier. So what does Cicero say about Sulla's bloody dictatorship in 63 BC, looking back on what happened in 80, which was only 17 years before, and Cicero lived through it? This is what he says about Sulla's bloody reign. Quote, all was basically admirable, though temper and moderation were somewhat lacking. So, a big hug and then a little small slap on the wrist. So the senatorial aristocrats say they didn't want one-man rule, but they did want one-man rule when it went their way, when it favored their class interests. Look, they even then supported, for the next hundreds and hundreds of years, emperors who came in. After Caesar and after the Second Civil War, it was Augustus who took over. They supported him. They never went back. They never advocated going back to a republican system. When push came to shove, their vast wealth meant more to them than state power. As long as state power was in the hands of someone who protected their vast wealth. That's the important thing to remember. Now, what's impressive is how many classicists of the modern era share the ancient ad hominem characterizations of Rome's reformist leaders. One of the things the ancients all say, and the modern guys accept it and repeat it and add adjectives of their own, the Gracchi were rash, erratic, power-hungry, demagogic, violating the Constitution, unlawful. Clodius was ruthless, unstable, unprincipled. So was Catiline, so was Saturninus, and of course, so was Caesar. This ascribing ad hominem devaluing attributes to popular reform leaders is a technique that still goes on to this day. Salvador Allende, I remember, he was called erratic and volatile and this and that. Noriega was like worse than Hitler and so forth. Milosevic was worse than Hitler, crazed, driven by his wife and so forth. Hugo Chavez, mercurial, erratic, dictatorial. I've yet to read a New York Times article about Chavez where they don't use the word mercurial, the mercurial leader, you know, volatile. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, the same thing. You know, not a word with Hugo Chavez, not a word about the clinics he set up for poor people in Venezuela. Poor people who for the first time in their lives are able to get medical attention. Not a word about that. Not a word about the tuition-free schools he set up for the people of Venezuela, for poor people who could never send their children to school because they couldn't afford the tuition before. Nothing about that. These ad hominem characterizations extend not only to the leaders, but to the people themselves. Throughout history, Gentlemen historians have been writing about the mob, the rabble, the people who are irrational, the people who do all sorts of things. The denigration of the common people as a shiftless, ignorant mob, dangerously irrational. Gustave Le Bon wrote a book called The Crowd. He wrote it about 130 years ago, in the late, relatively peaceful time of the late 19th century. And yet he sounds almost like a French aristocrat about to get whacked on the guillotine. He's talking about the raging, irrational mob. The book is called The Crowd. It's been kept in print for 130 years. For 130 years it's been used and given to students, certainly in the U.S. And the ancient Roman writers were no different, nor the latter-day classicists. This is what Cicero says about the Roman mob, the rabble. That's what he calls them. Beggars, convicts, madmen, urban scum, slaves, foreigners, exiles, a starving, contemptible rabble. He admits they're starving, you see. But he doesn't see that as symptomatic of their victimization. He sees that as a deficiency that's personal to them. You see, they're starving, unwashed. When you say when people are unwashed, they're dirty. Why do you think people are dirty? Because they can't afford to go to the baths, the Roman baths. They don't have any running water. They don't have any olive oil to clean themselves with. They don't have anything. So that's why they're dirty. But no, you blame the symptoms of oppression on the oppressed themselves. Well, who were these people? If you read these historians, you find they were layabouts, wastrels, you know, just irrational thrill seekers at the bread and just waiting to live off free bread and free circuses. Had nothing else to do. First of all, you couldn't live off the bread dough. The bread dough for the Roman proletariat made the difference between starvation and survival. But it wasn't enough. You can't just live on bread. You need money for fuel. You need money for rent. You need money for clothing. They worked. That's what the Roman proletariat did. I'll tell you who they really were. They were masons, carpenters, shopkeepers, scribes, glaziers, butchers, blacksmiths, coppersmiths. I gleaned all these professions from the various descriptions of everyday Rome. Bakers, dyers, rope makers, weavers, fullers, tanners, metal workers, scrap dealers, teamsters, dockers, porters, and various day jobbers. They were the toiling proletariat of Rome. And what did they do? What did they do in their time on the stage of history? This is what they did. They fought for two centuries against kingships and overthrew a kingship. They fought and mobilized and organized secessions, refusing to go in the army, refusing to participate and work, and going off the great Aventine secession and such to win the right to popular assemblies. They fought for secret ballot and got it. They made common cause with slaves, sometimes, not always. They supported land reform, debt cancellation, rent reduction. They supported popular leaders like the ones I've been talking about, the Gracchi and Caesar. And they bitterly fought and opposed Sulla. As I said, I found that ancient history is not so ancient. I'll read you my favorite quote by Schumpeter. Joseph Schumpeter was a conservative economist. He wrote this in 1919 about Rome. He talked about Rome's imperial policy. And I haven't said anything about Rome's imperial. Caesar was also an imperialist. There was other things about him. I do write about it in the book that are not so admirable. His conquest of Gaul, his plunder, and all that. Definitely. And this is what Schumpeter said. The Republic was also an empire, just as our Republic is also an empire. He said, Rome, that policy of Rome which pretends to aspire to peace, but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. The fighting was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their aggressive designs. So there you have it. That expansionism is not really a pursuit of power for power's sake merely. It's not just we want to have power and we want to rule. It's because they wanted to do certain things with that power. It's because they gained certain things. War and expansion was very favorable to the aristocratic class. They fleeced their own people. They fleeced the peasantry of the Italian peninsula. And they fleeced and they robbed from the entire empire. The Roman Empire was for them a very, very profitable thing. It was part of their self-enrichment, and that is something we should not forget. I was wondering if I could read something. I read a little piece of The Assassination. Would you like to hear that? This book has lots of sex and violence in it, by the way. I want you to know that. Let's see. On the penultimate day of his life, during the course of conversation while dining with Lepidus — Lepidus was Caesar's captain of the cavalry — and a few other intimates, Caesar posed an unsettling question. What is the best sort of death? After his companions ventured various opinions, he himself commented that a sudden, unexpected end was the one he would prefer. That night, the story goes, his wife, Calpurnia, dreamed of seeing him lying in her lap with many wounds and streaming with blood. The next morning, much distraught, she implored Caesar not to stir from the house and to postpone the Senate session. His wife's remonstrance gave him pause, since she ordinarily was a composed and level-headed individual. Not given to womanish superstitions, as Plutarch put it — that's in quote, womanish superstitions. Plutarch himself was richly freighted with superstitions, presumably male-gendered. He tells us that just before Caesar's death, fire issued from the hand of a soldier's servant, yet left him unburned, and he names a few other things. An animal sacrificed by Caesar was found to contain no heart, quote, a very bad omen, because no creature can subsist without a heart, the great historian reminds us. Omens aside, the political climate was disquieting enough. And Caesar himself had misgivings, and I go in here and I talk about that. And then I quote from Cicero's reassuring speech in the Senate and says, Caesar, how could you suspect that there are enemies here? We all love you. The way you have treated us so magnanimously, you won the Civil War and yet you gave us back all our land, and you've been such a wonderful guy. We swear we will protect you ourselves with our own breasts and bodies. I mean, these cloying reassurances did not leave him completely reassured. Now on the fateful morning of 15 March — 15 March is the Ides of March. The Ides in the Roman calendar are the 15th, 13th, 14th of every month. It varies, one of those days. There was the Calends, that's the first of the month, and the Nones are usually the 9th or 7th of the month. They just had the naming of something, and they would calculate things backwards from, they say, the third day from the Ides, which would mean March 12th. And the second day would be March 13, and so forth. It was a very cumbersome way of calculating the calendar. I gave that a page. That was about all it was worth, but it was kind of interesting. Now, on the fateful morning of 15 March, uneasy about Calpurnia's dream, Caesar turned to Antony, who had just arrived, and instructed him to go postpone the Senate session. But Decimus Brutus, one of the few to have regular access to Caesar's residence, entered as Antony was about to leave. On hearing of Caesar's decision, Decimus strongly urged a reconsideration. The senators have been waiting in attendance for some time. Decimus Brutus, by the way, not to be confused with Marcus Brutus, one of the key conspirators. Decimus was rather close to Caesar. He had been his general in Gaul, too. But when the final time came, choosing between his personal loyalty to Caesar or his class interests, he joined the aristocratic conspirators. Anyway, Decimus convinces him that the Senate — I'm going to paraphrase some stuff — They're going to be rather miffed if he doesn't show up. He called the session, and is it like Caesar to hide behind a woman's fears, or does he give in to superstitions like this? And why doesn't he at least come and tell them he's got to postpone, and maybe, you know, we can have this some other time? And then there's also stories that a Greek teacher of logic, who had been a former tutor of Marcus Brutus and caught wind of the conspiracy, had attempted to tip off Caesar. One version says he went to his house, but he had just missed him. Another was he got to him and gave him a warning paper, but Caesar never was able to read it because of the press of all the people around him and such. But anyway, Caesar makes his way into the hall. The conspirators stationed a backup complement of gladiators in the adjoining theater, which is an arena, really, who could rush to their assistance should senators loyal to Caesar give them trouble. They were especially concerned about Mark Antony, a physically powerful man not easily routed. He would likely be situated close to Caesar. So they contrived to have Gaius Trebonius, Antony's acquaintance and one of the conspirators, detain him in conversation outside the hall. Upon Caesar's entrance, everyone rose to their feet. A group of senators quickly gathered about him in an apparently friendly manner. Caesar had scarcely occupied the ceremonial chair when one of them, Tilius Cimber, petitioned that his brother be allowed to return from exile. Caesar waved him aside. This was not the time for such a matter. They could pursue it on some other occasion. Others moved close, pretending to join in the request. Then suddenly Tilius laid hold of Caesar's robe, yanking it down from his shoulder, the signal for the assault. The first blow came from behind, delivered by a trembling Publius Casca. It missed its mark, grazing Caesar about the shoulder. He whirled about, seizing his assailant by the arm, wounding him with a stylus he used for writing. Caesar then bolted forward, only to be slashed in the face by Cassius. Desperately flaying at his attackers and issuing furious cries like a trapped beast, he took another blade into his side, then swift thrusts into his thigh, his back, and his groin, until he staggered and collapsed, some say, at the base of Pompey's statue. Even then, the assailants continued savaging him with their daggers, some of them accidentally cutting each other in the melee. Suddenly, all was quiet. Caesar lay motionless, bleeding to death from 23 stab wounds. At this point, Marcus Brutus turned to the Senate assembly to reassure them that all was well. He would now set forth the reasons behind this act of tyrannicide. Certainly here was an apt venue for discoursing on the more unsavory imperatives of republican restoration. But the senators were in no mood for a civics lesson. Frozen in astonishment, for the brief seconds of the onslaught, they began stampeding out of the hall, tripping over each other as they fled, some fearing they might be the next victims, others just wishing to distance themselves from the murder and all its frightful implications. Brutus and his confederates followed them out, triumphantly brandishing their blood-stained weapons. Being still hot from their exploit, they marched as a body, not like perpetrators who thought of taking flight, but with an air of lordly assurance, calling to the people to reclaim their liberty and inviting persons of rank to join them. They didn't invite people to join them. They'd invite persons of rank. Some of the latter did enter their procession, acting now as if they too were authors of the bloody design and could claim a portion of its honor. In the empty meeting hall, Caesar's body lay crumpled in lonely silence throughout much of the day. Eventually, three of his slaves ventured in and carted it away. Thus did Gaius Julius Caesar meet his sorry fate in his 56th year on the Ides of March, 44 BC. 40 years earlier, on that very day, a graceful, handsome 16-year-old youth strode amidst a joyous gathering of family and friends who prayed that the divinity might fashion a brilliant destiny for him. It was a festival celebrating the threshold of spring on the Italian peninsula, when living things are touched by the sweet stirrings of nature reborn and people lift their hearts in the hope of better times to come. And so we too should hope for better times to come, and not only just hope, but we should struggle and fight for those better times. Thank you for your kind attention.
That was the acclaimed author, public speaker, and social critic, Michael Parenti. Parenti spoke about his Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. This rebroadcast is part of the very popular and ever-expanding series on what Parenti calls real history. That's a different and intriguing reading of a surprisingly large number of all too familiar stories, such as the myth of the founding fathers, the real causes of war, from the Spanish-American War to World War II, and the JFK assassination. Parenti grew up in a conservative, Catholic, working-class Italian community in New York City. After receiving his PhD in political science from Yale, he risked and ended his academic career when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam. Among his 22 books are Democracy for the Few, Super Patriotism, History as Mystery, God and His Demons, and The Face of Imperialism. This talk was recorded by Brian Berry at Modern Times Bookstore in San Francisco in the summer of 2003. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order an audio CD or a film on DVD of Michael Parenti's Assassination of Julius Caesar by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD or a film on DVD by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
We're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world via our online streaming service at our new website at cfmu.ca. And today we have special guest Christopher Black. He's an international lawyer and author who's going to be coming to speak in Hamilton not too long from now. So, Christopher, thanks very much for being on the program with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for having me on.
Well, it was great last time you were here, and we were talking about some related issues, and now, of course, you're going to be putting on a special presentation for us, and I'm going to have the details for that later in the program. But you probably don't know about this, as I only sent you the link recently, but I found out just a couple of days ago. I was just about to turn off Netflix. I had been watching TV Sunday night or something, and on that smart TV box, a CBC item popped up, and it said, U.S. revives Cold War-era planes to defend America. It was a four-minute segment. And it was this fawning CBC interview. This reporter went over to a U.S. airbase, and they were refurbishing these old B-52s, getting them in fly-worthy condition. And the reporter's like, wow, these are some big planes. And the military people were saying, well, you know, it's an old plane, but it's still great, and we can send it out. Everyone will see it, and there's something to be said about knowing that we can send this kind of force and power out there. So they go into the aircraft, and the reporter from the CBC says, oh, it's very tight in here. I can barely stand up in most places. Why is there so little space for people? And the Air Force personnel says, well, you know, it's, when they built this, they just wanted to see how many nukes they could cram into it. They wanted to fit as many nukes into it as possible. So that's what we did. So, you know, we got all these dummy nukes over here that we drill with, and we fit a lot of nukes in there, and that's what the B-52 does. And what we're going to do is we're going to fly it from here thousands of miles across the Pacific Ocean. We're going to fly it near the North Korean border. We're going to fly them and land them on Guam and patrol from there if necessary. So we're gonna fly these planes loaded with nukes as a big defiant symbol to North Korea that we're gonna protect America. These planes are here. Uh-huh. Now, of course, you know how ridiculous this is, because North Korea built those nuclear weapons that it's been showing off because the U.S. routinely has these huge. Right. You know, what can you tell us about these exercises and these provocations they do every year after year after year?
Well, they've been going on since the Americans occupied the southern part of the country after the Second World War, when they the Soviets occupied the north and agreed to the Americans going to the south, and the Japanese troops there only would surrender to the Americans and then cooperate with them to control the southern part of the country and suppress the socialist movements in the entire country, really. And out of that developed the Korean War, as we all know, and the division of the country ever since. So, but the military maneuvers have been going on since then, and they're meant to, A, control the South, to keep it within the American orbit, and to threaten the northern part of the country, northern part of Korea, and keep it intimidated and try and crush it so that the Americans control the entire peninsula and use it as a base to threaten China, of course. And interview on the CBC with the BBC about the B-52s is interesting because you may not know this, but in 1999, when Canada was bombing Yugoslavia and violating all sorts of international law and committing aggression against a European country, they weren't doing very well. A lot of planes were shot down. They weren't really damaging the Yugoslav forces very much. So the only way they got President Milosevic to finally give in was for the Americans to send two emissaries, a man named Ahtisaari, who won the Finnish diplomat who won the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago, and Chernomyrdin, who was Yeltsin's foreign minister at the time, went to see Milosevic in June 1999 and told him that they had a message from the Americans that unless the Yugoslav government surrendered, they intended to use B-52s, high altitude, to level Belgrade. And they intended to kill 500,000 people in 2 weeks. And that was what was going to happen if they didn't surrender. And that's why Milosevic finally gave in.
Well, what I know about the Yugoslav campaign, and it's also general knowledge among people who research these things, is that the U.S. did not do very well, as you pointed out, against the Yugoslav army and the Serbian army. It was only able to destroy something like 3 modern armored vehicles within 78 days. Basically, the forces that the U.S. was bombing, that NATO was bombing, were left intact, essentially. And the war was only ended because the U.S. bombed so much infrastructure, bridges and, you know, water treatment plants and stuff like that the Yugoslav government gave in because of the civilian cost.
Well, they could have withstood that, but what the final crunch was this threat to wipe out 500,000 people, like to destroy it. They were going to actually flatten Belgrade, the entire city, like they did Pyongyang in 1950-53. They flattened Pyongyang. There wasn't a building left standing, and they intended to do the same thing to Belgrade. That's what forced the Yugoslavs to give up.
Well, we know a lot about the American way of waging war.
Right.
You know,
so that's what they threaten now, and now they're threatening with nuclear weapons, so North Korea has to react, and it's reacting. So, as you say.
Well, you know, for those who are just tuning in, we are speaking with Christopher Black. He's an international criminal lawyer on the list of defense counsel at the International Criminal Court, and he was also part of a delegation to lawyers to North Korea. He writes for quite a number of online outlets. We might hear more about that. Now, Christopher, you're going to be coming here to Hamilton. You're coming to the New Vision United Church. A lot of our listeners are familiar with that location. We've had a lot of good events there. We've had Michelle Chosadovsky. We've had Eva Bartlett. We've had all sorts of people, Professor Kaborsi as well, Stephen Gowans, you name it. So it's a great venue. It's at 24 Main Street West, Hamilton, and it's going to be on Tuesday, March 20th at 7:30 p.m.
Right.
So, now, you're also going to be in Toronto, is that right?
Yes, on the 22nd at the University of Toronto, I think, the university building.
Oh, well, people can tune into the Taylor Report, will tell them in Toronto.
Right.
So. This is a wonderful event. It's called Immoral and Illegal: Economic Warfare and Threats of Annihilation Against North Korea. And that's precisely what we're dealing with, unfortunately. In the case of what's going on right now, you can talk about these provocations. You can talk about sending nuclear-armed B-52s to patrol along the Korean border there and all the escalation, all the problems. But one thing that's in contrast to all the reporting we've done on North Korea, South Korea, Korea as a whole, is that people are starting to see through the propaganda. Anyone who's watching this for a long period of time is getting a sense of things that's different from what the corporate media is promoting. Specifically, the North and South of Korea are not like two entities, brothers, family members who hate each other permanently. There's a lot of talk about reconciliation. I was on Facebook this morning and I saw there was a photo of the North Korean leader Kim with a South Korean counterpart. They were hugging.
Yes.
You know, this is not something you see. It reminds me of the Olympics, where it got to the point people were sending out amusing graphics on the internet of the North and South Koreans together and Vice President Pence out there in his own corner in the dark.
Right. That quite quickly suppressed in the Western media as soon as it came out that the North Koreans weren't starving. And they were all well-dressed and beautiful and happy. There was shock for a few days. Then they suppressed it. It was suddenly erased from the TV screens. But, when we were in Korea back in 2003, we were surprised to see many South Koreans in Pyongyang. And there was a lot of people. They call it a hermit kingdom. It's just, I don't know where they get that from, because Korea is quite an open country. We saw people coming in from all over the world to do things there, businesses and teaching, and there were people from Germany and Scotland and Saskatchewan and Africa coming in on the flights we were in. So it's not what people portray, but what we concluded was that the worst the propaganda is against a country, probably the more civilized it is. And they won't want you to know that. I mean, the reason that Americans ban their people going to Cuba, for instance, is not because they want to squeeze Cuba. That's partly it. But also, they don't want Americans to see what other possibility life could be like.
Well, a good example.
And North Korea is Cuba on speed. I mean, if you go to North Korea, you'd be really shocked. We were shocked because, frankly, I'm on the left, but even I half believed some of the propaganda I was fed. It was so intense. And when I got there, I was very pleasantly surprised and that it was one of the most civilized places I've ever been. And everybody we met who traveled there had the same impression. And it's not at all. It's just the people are the same as they are here. They're all fairly well dressed. They all go around to their jobs and do their things and have cafes and go to lunch and children play in parks. It's the same as everywhere else. They did tell me that they had trouble with food supply back in 1995-99 when the Russians cut their oil supply and they got hit by two big typhoons back-to-back, which wiped out the electrical system. And they had big trouble then, but they said, nobody ever starved here. We make sure all the people are fed when we believe in helping people, not making money off people.
Well, you know, you're suggesting, and it's not quite a joke, this is serious, that the more civilized a country is, the worse the propaganda is against it. I mean, you can easily point to the example of Cuba, which is a civilized place. I've been there myself.
Right.
You can look, I think, You gave an example right at the beginning of the program of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia, socialist Yugoslavia, was a civilized place, and Germany and the U.S. were doing everything they could to take it apart,
right,
which they did. You can look at Gaddafi's Libya.
Yes.
Look at it now, after it's been liberated by NATO. Right.
Right.
And you wonder where's
the liberation of Libya now when it's being run by all these thugs? I mean, the West admits they're all thugs and they're murdering people, but where's the liberation now?
Well, that's what Syria would look like right now if the Syrian government wasn't fighting against those very same thugs. Another country that was heavily demonized, even though it was one of the nicest places to live in the world before we decided to implement a regime change operation. So this,
right,
this is something you know a lot about, because you have been a consistent anti-war activist. You were there. I saw you doing the work on Yugoslavia. I saw you doing the work on Iraq. I saw you doing the work on Libya. You know, these are the kind of people we need to get around. These are the kind of voices we need to get around, because you have been conscientious and you have been a strong defender of international law and what the United Nations are supposed to stand for. And that's what we do here,
right,
on this station. And that's what I wanted to talk about with regard to North Korea, because, of course, you and Professor Kaborsi from McMaster are going to be addressing,
yes,
this subject on the 20th. And the content of the talk is economic warfare and threats of annihilation against North Korea. I want to reiterate that, because this is a very serious issue. We can talk about the damage that sanctions do and everything, but it's not just the usual business of the United States making its threats and cutting countries off from aid and medical supplies and the global economy, which they do, but Canada's been heavily involved in this too. You know, it was not long before the Olympics that there was some kind of summit out west.
Right. In Vancouver, yeah.
They were deciding the fate of Korea, and was Korea invited to that? North Korea wasn't there. The Russians, Chinese, it was one side. There were two sides in the Korean War of the 50s.
Right.
And the one side, Canada, U.S., and all those guys, they had a meeting to talk about what they're going to do about Korea.
That's right. That's why Dr. Graham McQueen proposed the idea of us writing his open letter that we did in the Toronto Star about that meeting, calling that it's an opportunity for the West to engage in dialogue and peace talks with North Korea and resolve things peacefully. But in fact, what they did was use it, it seems, as a meeting to concoct a criminal conspiracy to commit aggression against the people of North Korea and maybe genocide, because they're talking about annihilating the entire country. I mean, and the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court doesn't have jurisdiction over the United States, but could say something publicly, but sits there doing nothing. So the Canadian government engaged in, took part in a meeting, really, to concoct a conspiracy to commit genocide. And there was nothing said in the press about this here. I mean, people like I can say it, Professor Kaborsi can say it, Graham McQueen, you can say it, but what does the mass media say? The mass media goes along with the entire, really, propaganda campaign against North Korea and Russia. All the American enemies are adopted in Canada as our enemies automatically, because we don't have an independent foreign policy.
I don't think
we don't exist, yeah, as a country exactly, in fact, as far as foreign policy concern it goes. We're just an auxiliary to the United States.
Well, that's very true, and it's very much in our observation on issues like Palestine or Venezuela. There is no foreign policy that is independent in Canada. Even opposition parties, they adopt whatever Washington puts forward.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not dealing just with big bad Trump. We're dealing with Canada following these marching orders from Washington. You know, maybe you can help clarify it for us, because you talk about these sort of threats of genocide, and you talk about all sorts of illegal actions. What's Canada been planning? I remember there was talk about they're going to seize as many North Korean ships as they could and search them, and then Canada,
right,
piped in. We had some admiral or some naval staff come in and say, "Oh, we've got the ships. We've got the ships to go." And what's going on here?
Well, first of all, we don't. If they engage in seizing North Korean ships in the high seas, that's an act of war, and all hell will break loose if they try to do that. If it's not just piracy. And as far as Canada being able to do such a thing, where are they going to get the ships? We have a few, maybe three or four or five ships based in Vancouver. Half of them break down. Last year, I think one or two broke down in the middle of the Pacific, had to be towed back home. We got one submarine. This is a joke.
These jokes
can be used to provocate a world war. And it's just insane that they're actually talking this way against a sovereign country. How would Canadian people like it if the Americans decided they don't like anything with the Canadian government's doing, decided to impose the same sanctions on us, and the country started saying, well, we're going to start seizing Canadian ships? I mean, it's just absurd. But people to hear just shrug their shoulders and say, well, so what? You know, because they're busy with their lives and they don't care about anything else. But we have to try and make them care somehow, because otherwise the Americans are threatening to commit nuclear war against North Korea, and I think myself that the North Koreans have the capacity to hit North America. I mean, it can be very dangerous what's going to happen, not to the North Koreans, but for us as well. So it's just it's surreal, yeah, the way they're talking.
Well, it is surreal because, you know, the United States, Canada are used to beating up on faraway countries that are one-tenth the size of the United States, that aren't as economically developed and can't hit us here. And, of course, now they're playing chicken with a country that has demonstrated the ability to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles and detonate nuclear weapons. And, of course, that can affect us here. And it's really sad because people have been detached from the issue simply because they aren't being hurt by the wars and illegal actions that our own governments are engaged in. You mentioned these sanctions and all this kind of thing. It's amazing that I think people are going to start getting really tired of the U.S. putting sanctions on everyone. I mean, if you sanction Iran and, you know, you sanction Syria and you sanction North Korea and, you know, sanction Venezuela, pretty soon you're sanctioning half the world. Maybe they'll just trade with each other and stop trading with us, you know?
When they use the word sanction, I run the word sanction is used, it's almost a legal term, and they use it to give a veneer of legality to economic warfare, because these sanctions, so-called, they assume that the person imposing them has the right to do so. The United States does not have the right to impose sanctions on anyone, trade embargoes or war embargoes on anyone, any country. Only the United Nations can do that. And the sanctions, so-called, that the United Nations Security Council has imposed on North Korea are also illegal. In fact, I just found an open letter from three high U.S. State Department officials back in 2016. I don't know where I got it from. But in it, they say what I just wrote with another lawyer in a paper, is that the sanctions that the U.N. Security Council has imposed on North Korea are based on North Korea violating the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, that they violated the treaty by making nuclear weapons. Well, North Korea pulled out of the treaty in 2003. In January. So they have every right to produce those weapons, as do the members of the Security Council. And yet all the sanction resolutions imposed since then are all based on that one false premise, that they're violating a treaty. They're not violating any treaty. And because they refuse to kowtow to any of the sanctions they imposed then, there's more sanctions imposed for them violating the sanctions that were imposed. So they haven't got a leg to stand on. The sanctions are absolutely illegal. I don't know why China and Russia went along with them. They have to explain that themselves. Shame on them, but they may have their own strategic reasons why they've done so. But they haven't explained what they are. We can only speculate. But the Security Council had no right to impose those on North Korea at all.
Wow.
And North Korea said so in letters to the UN several times.
Yeah.
So, and now Dr. Kuperus, I'm probably sure, will have more expertise on the actual economic effects on North Korea. But if you read the reports to the UN Security Council from the various countries going ahead with these sanctions, so-called, they're pretty severe. I mean, they're embargoing almost every trade item you can think of, from iron to steel to coal to textiles, importation, exportation. But it seems that North Korea can perhaps survive on its own, but it's still going to be very difficult.
I really want to hear what Professor Kuperus has to say about the sanctions,
right,
because he's an international, world-renowned expert on this. He's written papers,
yes,
on the effect of sanctions in Iraq.
Right.
We all know that sanctions in Iraq killed well over 1 million people, something like 1.5 million, maybe 2 million people, citizens, civilians, were killed in Iraq by U.S.-led sanctions. And,
right,
you know, sanctions are a weapon of war that hits civilians. It's supposed to be done very carefully, but it's actually done quite broadly and widely by the United,
yeah,
States. And so, you know, when you talk about sanctioning North Korea, a country that the media likes to talk about suffering people in, well, you're going to have massive suffering as a result of these sanctions. You know, this is the kind of expertise we can get at this talk on March 20th, and this kind of expertise we want from you on the issues of international law, because as you pointed out, this is a very scary and almost surreal situation, because they are saber-rattling with a country capable of engaging in a nuclear exchange with us on the North American continent.
Right.
You know,
and the sanctions are also a war crime when they're imposed in the way they're imposing them, because they amount to collective punishment of a civilian population, which is a war crime, a crime against humanity, under the Rome Statute, under the Nuremberg Principles. embargoing a country so that the population suffers in order to put pressure on the government of that country to change its policies, that's a war crime, a crime against humanity, and that's what Canada is engaging in. They're willing to starve people because they don't like a government or like its actions. Where's the morality come from? Who has the morality? The victim or the person imposing the sanctions?
Yeah, the way the United States has treated
Iraq. It's just disgusting, really, what this country is doing, and the political parties in this country, the major political parties, that is, go along with all this.
There's such enormous room for improvement. Anyway, we can learn the details about the sanctions, what's being planned and proposed to be implemented, the nasty and devastating effect this could have on North Korea, as well as the very devastating consequences of a war in Korea, even a conventional war. And how this all fits into the international legal framework, and why these kind of activities really weaken an international system that's already circling a drain in terms of ability to keep international order, respect for sovereignty, stopping World War III. We're in jeopardy, and that nuclear clock has been pushed to something like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes to midnight.
Yes, yes, and I think President Putin just gave the warning last week. You know. Stop it all, or you don't know what's coming down. just back off and leave everybody alone. The thing is, I just saw, I have an article, an old article from 2003, CNN article, funny enough, which talks about the Americans willing to give the North Koreans a non-aggression pact, a statement that they will not attack if the North Koreans agree not to develop nuclear weapons. And yes, this week, North Korea again stated for the umpteenth time that we're willing to give up our nuclear weapons if you agree not to attack us. Now, I think they're naive. I don't think you can ever retrust more the American government. But they're sincere, because when I met them, they were sincere in that. They said, that's all we want, a peace treaty and a non-aggression pact. We don't want to waste our money on nuclear weapons. It's draining our energies, but we feel we have to. But we're willing to give them up if they promise not to attack us and remove all the military threats against us. But, of course, the Americans will not do that. They just, in response, what did Trump do just the other day? Impose more sanctions on North Korea. That's the answer. We don't want peace. We don't want to give peace a chance like John Lennon wanted. They want war. They seem intent on getting it.
Yeah, this seems like the exact crowd of numpties that got us into World War I. You know, kind of idiot. If you don't think that the current people leading the United States and Canada and Great Britain aren't as stupid as the people that got us into World War I, World War II, think again, you know, and this will be the last one. So, you know, if you're concerned about these kind of things, please come to our event. It's going to be at the New Vision United Church on March 20th. That's Tuesday. Tuesday, March 20th, New Vision United Church, 24 Main Street West here in Hamilton. The admission is free. Donations are accepted. It's sponsored by the Democracy Probe International and the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. A notice will be posted on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website within 24 hours from now at hcsw.ca. And Christopher, we're not simply interested in seeing you and Professor Kaborsi speak, but we also are interested in your writings. You know, you've done so much work on the issue of protecting what little peace and international order we have left. So where can we find your writings?
I've written for various journals. I write a lot for New Eastern Outlook, also known as NEO, or sometimes Global Research, once in a while Counterpunch, but on my own blog, ChristopherBlack.com, you might find some interesting things. But probably New Eastern Research, every once a week or so I publish something.
So that's Near Eastern Outlook at Journal Dash.
New Eastern Outlook. Yeah.
Right. Perfect. Well, thanks so much for being on the program. We're going to announce this and give all the details again. And of course, we'll see you on the 20th here in Hamilton.
Right. I'll look forward to it.
Great. Thanks very much, Chris.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye. That was Christopher Black, and yes, he is an international criminal lawyer, and he is an author who writes quite a large number of well-informed pieces on the dangers of war with Korea, the dangers of nuclear war with Russia, the stupidity of this whole Russiagate and Russophobia, as well as problems with all the other interventions from Libya to Syria and so on. So do keep aware of that, and do come to the event on March 20th. This is very important, and we've noticed there are a lot more people concerned about potential of war with North Korea than we've had in recent months, recent years, given the severity of the conflict that could result if some idiots actually manage to land us into a war with Korea, something that Koreans don't want on the Korean Peninsula. But the U.S. seems to find endless excuses to have its nuclear-armed bombers fly right along the border and have massive exercises and tens of thousands of soldiers and ongoing constant saber rattling and endless propagandizing on TV networks and sanctions and so on. This is a dangerous situation. It's something we don't need to be part of. Let the record stand. As Christopher said, North Korea said, hey, okay, we'll give up the nuclear weapons. Can you give us a non-aggression pact so that you won't attack us? Can you do that? The U.S. said no.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.